Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Fagan. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to ArkOfMillionsOfYears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live from deep beneath the Earth in western Kentucky, where it is a balmy 21 degrees. Tomorrow it's going to be about 9 degrees. The solar wind tonight is a light 340.9 kilometers per second. Sunspot 940 is still alive and has developed some massive filaments as wide as Earth and over 150,000 kilometers long. These hold the potential for some significant solar flares. These filaments may become even more unstable, causing a massive coronal mass ejection. Sunspots 940 and 941 have been quiet for days, which is a little confusing to solar scientists who usually count on these filaments causing some real surface action and some solar flare activity. We'll see what happens in the next few days. 14 hours ago, NASA released its plan for a new moon base on the south pole of the moon. It stays lit 75% of the time, and it has the minerals we need to mine for power and supplies on the moon. A manned flight of the new Orion exploration vehicle without a moon landing is scheduled in 2014, and in 2020 to go to the moon with a short surface visit. NASA envisions people living on the moon for six-month durations by the year 2024. That's in my lifetime, folks, so I am setting my goal to have a new mailing address somewhere around 2025. Stay tuned. We'll take you with us. Next week on X Squared Radio, I will be at the Conscious Life Expo speaking at 6 p.m. on Sunday. Yes, there might be enough time for a live broadcast from the Expo Center, but no promises. If you write me this week and ask me, I'll see who I can get to come up and have an interview while I'm at the conference, and we'll bring them live on the air. It could be exciting. The following week, on the 18th, we have Mark Pinkham coming on the program. You know he is the world's expert on the Holy Grail and the Templars, and I promise we'll go places no other host will take you. We licensed some items from Mark for our books, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volumes 1 and 2. So you know we are going into some of the deepest lore of Freemasonry for your edification. You know, we have always had an open invitation to anyone who has a UFO experience to come on X Squared Radio and share it live. About 10 days ago, I had a live call from Charlotte, North Carolina, where a repeat event took place. As you know, Wednesday of that week, there were 9/11 911 calls were heavy from South Carolina all the way to Southern Virginia with a large UFO sighting that occurred over Charlotte. Well, 2 days later, on Friday, it returned and stayed over the city for 45 minutes. I got a call from outside a coffee shop in a parking lot where witnesses were watching it on Friday night. It was greenish in color and appeared to be about 200 feet across. Officials discounted it for Chinese space junk re-entering the atmosphere the first night, but there were no such explanations for the second night. We talked about it live. Well, tonight we have a guest on our program who has collected and reported on some of the most powerful sightings we have had in our nation's history. I hear people say all the time, "Well, I'll believe it when they land on the White House lawn." Well, Earth explorers, they have done just that and more. And tonight's guest has the story for us. He is the editor of Unicus Magazine and has written an outstanding book called UFOs Over Washington. I want you to welcome with me Robert Stanley. Good evening, Robert.
Evening, Brooks. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I want to just clarify something. The actual title of the book is Close Encounters on Capitol Hill.
Oh, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. Right. My apologies.
That's right.
All right. Well, Robert, I know you've been editing for a long time, been writing for a long time. What got you on the trail of writing this book?
Specifically, this book was photographs that I saw in the spring of 2005. These pictures were forwarded to me from Washington, D.C. The photographer that took these pictures had worked for ABC News for some 18 years. 8 of those years were spent working at the White House, Air Force One, Marine One, and he was not working at ABC at the time, but he was doing freelance jobs around Washington, D.C. And within 4 months, on 3 occasions within 4 months, he accidentally took pictures of UFOs in the prohibited airspace of Washington, D.C.
Wow.
The most profound picture, though, that we need to be discussing tonight and for many years to come, it's actually a series of photographs. He started taking them. It was July 16th, It was about 12:30 in the morning, and he was at the Capitol building, and he was shooting an album cover for a local recording artist. And at that time, he took a series of images which show that not only did one UFO land on the Capitol building roof, but other UFOs landed, touched down, and were hovering over Capitol Hill for at least a good 20, 30 minutes that night.
Wow.
Now, yeah, there was more than one, obviously, as I said, and these... Hello, Brooks?
Yeah, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, that sounds a little better, I think.
Hope so.
I'm not exactly sure what was going on there, but we got it fixed.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have things happen.
Well, hello, Brooks.
Ah, that sounds a little better on my end. I seem to hear a little tiny ringing in the background, but I think we'll just have to live with it unless it's really bothering people out there.
All right.
All right, so you received a photograph from an individual, and the photograph so impressed you that you decided to follow up on it and see what you could find out about it.
Here's how it went. I was forwarded the email from Washington, D.C. with the photographs by my friend Daryl Sims in Texas. He had sent it out to all his contacts in the media, basically asking us what we thought of these photographs, because he, not being a photographic expert, didn't know if this was fake or not. And so I looked at the pictures, and I was skeptical because I figured, hey, if that event happened as portrayed in those images, I think I should have known about it with, you know, I think we're looking at about almost 3 years after the fact. I should have heard something about it, but that was not the case. So the photographs actually came with contact information to the photographer. So I called him up, and he answered the phone, and we talked, and we talked, and we're still talking after almost 2 years later.
Wow.
Well, and we're exchanging emails, and he's been briefing me on everything that he's learned because the analysis is ongoing. But at some point I talked to him, and I said, look, you got to have the negatives analyzed independently, which he did. And that's in the book. I think you read that in that free chapter that's on my website at unicusmagazine.com.
Right. So he had the photograph independently analyzed.
Yep.
For authenticity, to make sure no one had messed with him.
That's correct. Because in this day and age, I mean, I think a lot of researchers assumed incorrectly that this was done in Photoshop. And granted, you could take the negatives and scan them in there and then doctor them up afterwards with Photoshop, but you can't. It doesn't go the other way around. In other words, you take 35-millimeter negatives, which is a celluloid, and if you tamper with them at all, there will be evidence of that tampering to the trained eye of a film technician.
Right.
So that's who we took it to, was a film lab in Washington, D.C., who just happens to do a lot of work for the FBI, and... I spoke to the technician afterwards, verified that he actually did the analysis, and then I transcribed the dialogue that took place, and I incorporated it into the book so people can see that this was done, and I think it was done scientifically. I mean, because, you know, the film is considered forensic evidence in a court of law, and, I mean, it's one thing to have an eyewitness testimony to corroborate what is on the film, and how it was acquired, but, you know, the fact of the matter is we do have physical evidence in the film. And why that's important is because the spectrum of energy that is captured on that film is beyond any other light source that we know of traditionally. It's not native to this planet.
Really?
Yes. Yes. And that's why the ongoing analysis, because a lot of the computer programs, even the state-of-the-art Photoshop CS2, cannot analyze some of these colors. It's not in the traditional spectrum of known colors that we normally work with. And moreover, the amount of energy that was coming off of these objects has to be taken into account. Some people who are skeptics have said to me, well, how do you know that wasn't just a balloon with candles on it or lens flares or things like that? Well, as I stated in Chapter 1 of the book, this cannot be lens flares because the glass he was using, the Nikon lenses, which are very expensive, they're classified ED, which from the manufacturer guarantees 100% distortion free. So even and moreover, if it was a lens flare, it would look like a lens flare, and the technician that had analyzed the film would have known to say, "Hey, this is lens flaring here."
Now, did this event occur more than once?
Well, are you talking about July 16th when they landed?
No, I mean, you said he took photographs several times.
Oh, yeah. The first one was July 4th of 2002, and he was actually under the employment of the city of Washington, D.C., wanted to get some pictures of the night skyline with the fireworks. That was the first time he accidentally caught these unknown objects flying around the prohibited airspace, which the heart of it starts right there at the Washington Monument. That's on the National Mall. And then it radiates out there from there. And then that prohibited airspace is surrounded by restricted airspace. And this is no joke. The military does take action whenever anybody or anything penetrates restricted and then prohibited airspace. They will take action, or at least monitor it very closely. And things got much more tight there, and as far as the restrictions on air travel, right after 9/11, obviously.
Right.
Okay. So this happened July of 2002, and then of course things got much more intense after 2003. But that didn't stop the UFOs. They kept coming. They find Washington D.C. incredibly interesting. And what I really was amazed at, once I decided to take on this story and do some background research into Washington, D.C., like most researchers, I knew that something happened in 1952 because that was published worldwide in the newspapers. But what I didn't know was how many times UFOs have been actually seen in Washington, D.C. So my book has it has 224 eyewitness accounts of UFO and or alien sightings in Washington, D.C. proper within a 150-year period.
So we're talking about an area that has the highest radar, highest security, highest all kinds of scanning available on Earth, because obviously it's the command and control of the United States of America.
Correct.
And I don't think you're allowed to fly a radio-controlled airplane over the White House, let alone an airplane.
No. You get in big trouble for doing that.
Yeah. So here we have. Now, how many events have we had in recent history? I know, like 1952, there was this massive sighting that made worldwide press. But
yeah.
These days, those kinds of events don't really make worldwide press because people just kind of go, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's say the last 8 years or since 2001, since 9/11, how many events have happened that there have been made reports on since then?
You mean unofficially?
Yeah, officially, yeah. Unofficially, you know, 911 calls, police calls, reports of various kinds.
Well, here's the most important thing is after they landed July 16, 2002, they showed up again 10 days later on July 26. People on the ground saw this. One of the witnesses was a retired Washington, D.C. police officer who was working as a security guard at night at a local gravel pit in Maryland. He saw the jets chasing a UFO, so he called the local radio station and explained what he was seeing. This alerted other people to look up, and they saw very much the same thing. And then Fox News got a hold of it, and they aired that on their television news broadcast, and the Washington Post also covered the story, and then other people picked it up somewhat in the sense that they made a comparison to 1952 because it was the 50-year anniversary of the world being told through the huge headline banners on the front of all the newspapers was saying invasion of Washington by UFOs.
Yeah, I'll bet it did.
Well, and it scared the military to no end back in 1952 because we were during the Cold War, but I'm sure they were also very upset when it happened in 2002 because, like I said, after 9/11, anything in the air was considered a threat, especially if it was headed towards the Capitol building or the White House or the Pentagon, which are all very close to each other.
Yeah. Did they scramble any kind of military equipment to try to intercept some of this?
On July 26th, NORAD instructed the National Guard to scramble jets out of Andrews Air Force Base. The official report is that they didn't see anything. Yet the people on the ground saw something very significant, which was the jets were attempting to chase the UFO out of the area.
What does that mean, attempting?
Well, they couldn't keep up with it. They were simply outmaneuvered by this object, whatever it was. It was spherical. And you got to understand, these things can emit any color of light, depending on the frequency, much like a rainbow. You know, depending on the angle that you're looking at it, you're going to see a prism of color. And they create this sort of plasma, ionized field around themselves. It's part of the field propulsion system of these craft. Some of them are manned, some of them are obviously unmanned, but they're intelligently controlled. They're obviously artificially built. They don't just grow themselves. And I know that our military's been trying to build things like this for some time, but unless they have acquired an amazing capability overnight somehow to create a wormhole in space, then that's not our stuff, because that was the final picture that was taken on July 16th, 2002, around 1 in the morning, Senate side of the Capitol, shows four objects, four UFOs, literally warping space, creating a wormhole, Stargate, whatever you want to call it, and leaving our atmosphere through this interdimensional portal. And that's all on film, Brooks, and it took us months to even realize what we were looking at.
Wow. Now, this obviously happens over Washington, D.C. Fortunately, we have a trained ABC photographer. We have obviously great observation, accidentally or on purpose. Is there a reason maybe why this one photographer seems to have gotten a series of great shots on UFOs in such a populated area, do you think?
Yeah, it's because he was contacted as a child. The first time he was 4 or 5 years old, he was living in England. His father was an Air Force officer, so they always lived on base housing, if not on the base, nearby. And that was the first time he had contact with extraterrestrial biological entities, as he puts it. And he said it scared him to no end, that his brother would not wake up. He was trying to get his brother to wake up as these beings entered the room. And essentially he was abducted and returned. But his life was never the same after that. The second time it happened to him, he was about 9 or 10. He was outside Fort Dix in New Jersey. And this time only one entity entered the room. And he doesn't have full recollection of what happened after the being entered the room, which is pretty typical, because they use some sort of hypnosis on us.
Right.
To either erase our memory or block us from consciously recalling what's going on. Highly manipulative. Whoever these little buggers are, they're not here for our best interest, as far as I can tell.
So he has an encounter as a youth, and you think, well, he thinks, or maybe we're drawing the conclusion, that he's had either lifetime contact with them, or he has been selected somehow to be able to bring this evidence, albeit sketchy. I think the photographs are probably pretty clear, but landing on the White House lawn and coming out and saying, "Here we are," is quite a bit different than flying over the White House or landing on the White House lawn mm-hmm. without coming out.
Yeah.
But it seems as though that this photographer has been selected to be involved in some way.
You're right, Brooks, but there's a lot of people that have been that never go public because they don't want to be ridiculed. And I think the way it happens was that The photographer, if he'd continued working at ABC News, first of all, he wouldn't have been there that night. He would have been on assignment from ABC News. And I can guarantee you, if that happened while he was on assignment, ABC would have owned that film, and we never would have seen it. Also, because his father was a high-ranking Air Force officer, a few months after he took the pictures and he was trying to figure out what to do with them, I mean, the first person he went to was his contacts at ABC, and they turned him down flat. Other people that turned it down were Washington Post, National Geographic, and a host of others have turned him down because they don't want to deal with this hot potato. But anyway, his father was, in 2002, the reason he left ABC is because his father was dying due to exposure to Agent Orange in the laboratory, not in the field.
Right.
He was one of the officers that actually was there at the laboratory where they were putting together the munitions that they would use ultimately on civilians, and as well as other military human beings, were basically, it's a biological warfare, is what it was. And
yeah, it was a defoliant. It was made to strip the leaves off the trees. So
that's
that,
what they. That's
no
what they say.
Cover.
Yes, Brooks. That's what they tell us. But it's biological warfare. It was. They knew they weren't just doing that. It was. It was absolutely horrendous what happened. In fact, like I said, people that were anybody got near it, even our own guys got sick from it.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, his father, in November of 2002, the photographer showed the pictures to his father who was dying, a very painful, agonizing death, by the way. And his father, when he looked at those photographs, he got really angry. And he said, don't you ever show those pictures to anyone, ever. Basically, he was ordering him. Now, you got to understand, the photographer is a civilian, and he was allowed to do that, whatever he wants, essentially, within the law. But his father had ordered him not to, and he said he if his father had lived, he would have honored his wishes.
Yeah, he would have never shown the photographs.
Well, at least not while his father was alive.
Right.
Okay, so it's only, and it's a tragedy that his father died like that, but ultimately that's the only reason we're getting to look at these pictures now. Now, let's back up. 1952, reportedly hundreds of still photographs and some movies were taken during 1952 in D.C. of the UFOs as they flew over, because they didn't just fly by. Sometimes they were there for 6 hours at a shot. And the military went around after the fact, and they confiscated all the film and cameras and movies of those events. And they classified all that footage.
Wow.
To this day. Now, you've got to tell me something. Do you think they would have done that if those were just lens flares or temperature inversion layers or Venus?
No, I don't think they would have. And frankly, I think the citizen of 1952 is quite a bit different than the citizen of 2002 or 2007. We inherently do not trust our government. We do not release everything that we have to our government. But in 1952... people were patriots, and if they were told to do something by the government, they did it.
Right. Well, a few seconds of one of those movie films actually did get aired on television once in, I think it was May of 1995. Oddly enough, Walt Disney Studios were given access to that, and they aired it during a TV documentary special about extraterrestrial encounters.
Wow. When was that? When did they air that?
May of 1995. I think it was May. It's in the book, but I think it was May of 1995. And I contacted Disney Studios just in the last year, and I spoke to their archivist, and they said, yes, we have a copy of that here, but you have to go through the legal department. Well, I've tried. The photographer tried. I've asked other people in the media to try and contact Disney legal department and ask them nicely to release a copy of that documentary. See, it only aired once on television. It was never made available after the fact. And, the only reason I know about it is because people posted this information on the Internet, along with a couple stills, or actually one still photograph that somebody captured off of the video that they got from the TV, you see. But the actual footage, or I should say a copy of that classified footage, does exist in a vault at Walt Disney Studios in Burbank, California.
That doesn't fall under the Freedom of Information Act, does it?
I don't know what you'd have to speak to somebody that's in a legal department to know But, you know, hey, come on, they already aired it. And so what we're asking is that they release it again so that it can be broadcast again for everybody in the proper context. You see, because in 1952, the official story is that UFOs showed up two or three times, which is significant in and of itself because they were seen on the radar, they were seen visually, the military went to intercept, and the UFOs would play games with them. But what I didn't know until I started my investigation was that they were actually seen 22 times that year. That is a record. For the database that I compiled, that's actually double the numbers of any other year so far. So there was something huge going on in 1952 around the world. UFOs were seen on a regular basis. It's what they call a flap. But Washington, D.C. proper was a major, major destination for whoever it is that builds and flies these UFOs.
Well, that would seem to lead one to believe that they're not here to sample cattle or take water samples or mine gold or get something like that. They're actually here to either monitor the leadership of the free world or to be involved with that leadership somehow.
Right.
Are there any reports of these UFOs coming really close, like not just being up in the airspace, but actually coming down close to one of the buildings that we associate with the leadership of our country?
You mean before they landed? Yes, there are eyewitness accounts of these things coming so close that the people actually dove on the ground because they thought it was going to crash into the building. These are not just things. I mean, they've been seen over the city, even way high above the city, loitering for hours at a time. Sometimes they'll come down very close, pass by very quickly. Other times they have been sighted to land, but without the photographs to prove it, or some sort of individual that can take a lie detector test. I've reported these things, but I don't know how accurate they really are, you see. But, you know, let's go back to 1930s. There was a Reverend Holt that said his cousin, who was, I think he was the Secretary of Defense or State Department at the time, I'm trying to think of his name. It'll come to me in a second. Anyway, he claims he was taken down there, sworn to secrecy, and taken to the sub-basement of the Capitol and shown dead alien bodies. He didn't know these were aliens. I mean, at that time, nobody even knew about little gray aliens, so they didn't call them. They said creatures in what appeared to be glass, large glass containers suspended in a liquid. He said that there was also a dismantled UFO. Again, he didn't call it that. He just said it would look like some sort of metallic craft that had been partially dismantled.
So it looked a little bit like the pictures that we saw on Independence Day.
Something like that, yeah. But you gotta. So here's the funny thing. The daughters of Reverend Holt released this information in 2002. Oddly enough, the same year that these things landed on the Capitol building. So I did a little investigation just to see, you know, if there was any truth in the matter.
Right.
And what I found out was that Reverend Holt's cousin, hold on a second, I got to see who this man's name is. Hull, Cordell Hull, was Secretary of State. He was the man that was responsible for us becoming part of the United Nations, or actually for the United Nations even emerging at all. He was no stranger to the Capitol building. He'd been working there for decades by the time that this alleged event went down. So the thing about Reverend Holt, though, is that he was a very credible, very candid individual. He had written a book. He was a reverend. He was an esteemed member of his community. So unless his daughters just went off the deep end one day and crafted this insane letter about their father, a very respected man, who they claim said, "Don't tell anybody about this till I'm passed away."
Wow.
It's just bizarre. I mean, why would they make up something like that unless there was some validity to it? And like I said, Secretary of State Cordell Hull was very well connected with secret societies. He was instrumental in getting secretly bringing in Germans and fighting Hitler covertly. And he knew that Hitler was part of the Thule Society and much other. I mean, he was very well informed, is what I'm trying to say. So here's the bottom line. I can't prove that these bodies and this craft was actually there under the sub-basement, but it kind of makes sense why they might UFOs might be interested in going there after the fact.
Well, yeah, now that's a good idea, that maybe they were there to recover the remains and the technology that they that had been left behind or had inadvertently crashed or somehow become disabled here on this planet. That is a good reason. The only other thing I could think of is, like you said before, we were embroiled in the Cold War. There were great tensions, nuclear tensions,
right,
on the Earth at the time. And frankly, I think the nuclear tensions that were on the Earth at that time, in the early 50s, really aren't as great as the nuclear tensions we have now in the world. Because at least then you had two superpowers that had sort of, they had recently seen the devastating power of nuclear weapons, and that we were in sort of a stalemate of production and muscle flexing, which we called mutually assured destruction, or appropriately acronymed MAD. But now we do not have any such balance. We have factions who are not afraid of the retaliation of the United States, and frankly, given the retaliatory performance we've done in the last 10 years, I don't blame them. And so maybe now we're at a point where we're probably closer to a nuclear encounter of some kind than we were 40 years ago.
Yeah, but Brooks, in during the 50s, we were actually exploding these things not only underground, under the water, but up in the upper atmosphere.
Oh, we certainly were.
And that would definitely get somebody's attention, and here's why. It's because something to do with the nucleus of an atom we still don't know for sure, but possibly people are saying it's a singularity, which means it could be a gateway to another dimension. And if that's the case, when we start blowing up nuclear bombs and splitting these nucleuses or trying to fuse them together, we could be messing with the very fabric of the universe in a way that these other beings who are obviously doing the same thing in a slightly different way, that would concern them to some degree.
Well, if it, as you say, is a multi-dimensional method they use for travel, it's quite possible that the catastrophic explosion of a fusion weapon does create ripples in gravity, in space-time, in maybe the peace and safety of other dimensions, which are right next door to ours.
Right, parallel.
So, yep. You know, we third-dimensional beings have a tendency to believe that UFOs don't exist because, well, they're so darn far away, and no one's going to travel for 400 light-years to get here. But what you are, well, we're going to open this up in the second hour, this way of travel that may be as simple as Riemann's cut, where you just simply slide between the third dimension and the fourth or the fifth, and distance is not what we think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So these ships use, or apparently use, a sort of plasma to move around. They're not using a fuel that runs out readily. They don't have to keep refilling their tanks, so they can just go where they want to go and where they need to go. And you also mentioned that they emit a spectrum of radiation in color that cannot be made on this planet.
Nope, and not only that, when you talk about radiation, they have been historically documented to burn soil, plants, cars, and people in the process of coming too close. When these UFOs come close to anything, it tends to override an electrical system. People tend to be burned and sickened by it. It's very well documented. And the reason I mention this is because on July 16th of 2002, the final photograph that the photographer took, he felt like he was in the midst like a thrust of something, but it was like a very fine mist that blew past him. And then later he found out that, the next day, he noticed that his fingertips were scorched and that the hair on the top of the middle top of his head was rapidly falling out, just in that one local area. And so, you know, he had himself checked out, and he found that, you know, this was some sort of radiation burn on his fingertips. And I said, his hair is growing back, and his nails eventually recovered after about a year and a half. But all the fingernails on his fingertips were burned by this sort of radiation.
Wow.
And I think part of the reason that happened is because unintentionally is when what I've been able to research about, if humans could create a wormhole or stargate, whatever you want, whatever term you prefer, as that hole collapses, it emits, theoretically, it would emit a backwash of radiation called Hawking's radiation. I guess it's something that Stephen Hawking must have figured out about. If you could create an artificial black hole and it was stable, at some point it would have to collapse, and once it did so, excess energy would be, you know, would come squirting out. And apparently that's what happened.
Yeah. When Stephen and Kip Thorne and others, have thought about forming black holes or these wormholes, various mathematical experiments have been performed with the model.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears, because of the large distances that can be traversed with these black holes, that time itself gets surpassed. And it's sort of like taking a microphone of a powerful amplifier and putting it up next to the speaker.
You get feedback.
Yeah, the speaker puts out a little bit of noise, which goes into the microphone, it gets amplified, it comes out the speaker, and you get, if the amplifier could put out enough power, it would destroy itself.
That's correct, and the same thing happens with lasers, and that's what these guys are doing. They're building the energy up until it's like a fractal. They obviously are controlling it with some very advanced computers, because this is not a calculation you want to do in your head, And they like I said, you know, if this is our military doing it, well, then we have no business flying F-16s and shuttles and things like that. You should just scrap all that tomorrow and start using the better technology. But I don't know. I don't see that happening anytime soon. And I really don't think we have that level of technology yet, but somebody does.
Well, I think we're rapidly getting there. I remember... Oh, gosh, late 60s. I'm going to say 68.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the University of California at Irvine, and we had computers there, but it took up a whole room, and they were the 2-inch wide tape and, you know, very, very advanced stuff. This was a brand-new university back then. And I remember the computer rep coming in, and he was upgrading our RAM, and he upgraded us to 8K of RAM. and he said, no one will ever need more than 8K of RAM. Now, we thought we were really cooking. Well, at least we didn't have to use punch cards. We could actually use keyboards, which seriously, I didn't get past until I was a sophomore in college many, many years later.
Wow.
I was just one of those prodigals that had lucky access to high technology when I was very young. But... what I see now is that computers, still stuck in the binary age, are getting faster and faster all the time.
Right.
And I think that we're getting very close to making the jump to trinary and even quaternary logic. Once we do that, mm-hmm. of course, everything is going to change. The speed that we can calculate things, the memory that we require to crunch programs and process them is going to completely change. I think we're about ready for it.
Well, if you've read Kurzweil, you know that he's a big proponent of this artificial intelligence emerging from like things like the Internet, and I think he's right, and I think these things already do exist, that the ETs or aliens or whatever you want to call them already have that capability where your brain waves can literally be read by the so-called intelligent machine. And in other words, you can control something which is through thought patterns. And it's already being done here. I mean, there's examples in the book there of the various corporations that have moved from this skull cap with electrodes now to just, you just wear the thing and it's it's reading your brain waves, and that's translated into commands for a machine or a computer. But
well,
you touched on something really important, Brooks. You talked about time travel, and apparently that's part of what these beings are capable of. And because of that, that's one of the reasons they're so advanced when it comes to, because think of it, if you could time travel, you would know everything. You wouldn't even have to read about it in a book. You would have experienced in firsthand the things that really happened in history and the things that are yet to happen to the rest of us in the future. You would know exactly what went down, and you would become a much more well-educated person.
Well, that's my thought, too, that if time travel is ever possible, mm-hmm. then it's possible right now, because those beings that are out there studying, they're going to come back to the past, and the past is now, which means they're visiting us now, sometimes to learn, and maybe we do something really dumb about now that affects things later, and they come back to sort of nudge things in the right direction to get another future out of it.
Well, that's assuming that we're talking about benevolent beings here, because that's the other problem that I really have a problem with this, is that the malevolent beings that can time travel are highly manipulative, and one of the reasons people forget anything about what happened is, for example, let's say you're taken out of your bedroom at 3:30 in the morning, you're gone for 2 hours, and they put you back at 3:30 in the morning. Well, that's going to kind of mess up your whole consciousness, and apparently this is only part of what's being done. And furthermore, if they're not all little gray aliens, some of the alien life forms that live here on this planet among us are human, totally human, and that is an issue. Now, some people are telling me, well, then they must be up to no good because they're here covertly. It's not my take on it at all. I think the good guys are here covertly to help us, because the bad guys are here covertly as well. And rather than just start an all-out war between themselves here, they're fighting it out behind the scenes. And most of us are none the wiser, unfortunately.
Well, I really want to believe that. I'm a scientist and have to deal in facts and
right.
direct observations, which mm-hmm. I've had some direct observations which really fly in the face of some facts that I know,
mm-hmm.
And I have talked about them here on the air, but I don't want to go into that tonight. What I want to try to do with this whole UFO thing, because it's really, really talked about on a lot of programs, what I'd like to do tonight, because it appears that your expertise is much better than anyone else I've ever interviewed on this program on the subject, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being on. And
thank you.
I already know this 3 hours is going to go way too fast. time for a physicist, it doesn't make any difference whether time is going forward or backward for us. It's, in other words, from my house to Nashville, Tennessee, is exactly the same distance as from Nashville, Tennessee to my house.
Right.
We think of time in terms of distance, but in gravity, because as gravitational forces change, time changes. And mathematically, we know that if we manipulate those gravitational forces and create these wormholes or stargates, that time is no longer a barrier for the traveler.
Right.
The traveler is going to age normally, but he's going to be able to move forward and backward in time at will.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know what that means. I don't know what it means to go to the future and bring information back to the past. But I have evidence that just the observation effect of
yes.
human consciousness can go to the future and can go to the past and can affect the present.
Well, and so you got to take it to the next level. If you could go to the future, come back to the past, you would definitely have made a difference. But typically, I mean, like scientists say, that the grandfather paradox doesn't allow for these things, or that if it did, you would sort of cancel yourself out. And my understanding of it is that that's not how it really works, because the universe is a fractal hologram, that you're literally creating just more fractals within the hologram that, in other words, you can create infinite amount of timelines, and therefore you know, things are just not as fixed as we might want to believe. So there's a lot of room for manipulation, both good and bad.
Well, yes, and the point is that we literally can and probably do experience all of these futures. It's just the one that we're in right now, the one that seems real to us, the one that we just can't believe is an illusion, is the one we're in right now. And what people need to realize is that the reality that's occurring is a product of all of the consciousness of the universe working at the same time. It can't function as this universe missing a single soul in it.
Yes, as a collective on this planet, yeah, we do have a role in creating our reality. There's no doubt about that, because I'm sure you study chaos and complexity theory, and you know about the butterfly effect.
Sure, the butterfly effect is a small change, like rounding off a decimal point, can have a massive change in destination later on.
Exponentially, it grows exponentially. Even the most smallest event is connected to all other events, so there, you can't discount anything, is what I'm saying. But again, this is why I find it's irresponsible of us as a species, collectively, to deny that anything paranormal or extraordinary is going on, because it opens us up to manipulation from those who are not benevolent. And I'm a little frustrated with the way that the media is handling this story, because I understand it's one thing if UFOs are seen landing in a cornfield or photographed maybe over the Kremlin even, but when they land on the Capitol building and we have photographs of it, I would hope that more of the mainstream media would pay attention. And I they're not. At this point, they're absolutely running scared from the story. And I got to say, even people like Matt Drudge and Jeff Rentz, I have emailed these guys repeatedly and shown them the photographs, and they will not stand up for this particular story. Now, I understand if there's a ridicule factor there. And where did that come from? It didn't happen out of the ethers. It was done intentionally. The main people I can see who are behind it is the CIA. The Robertson panel back in 1957, they said that UFOs don't pose a threat to our national security, but the public's perception of UFOs does pose a threat. So therefore, we're going to have to set out to manipulate the public's perception of these things in a way that we feel is advantageous. So we've been set up, I mean, from within, I believe. And that's one of the reasons that most people, as UFO researchers, there's very little cohesion amongst us. Most of us don't agree on just about everything is up for debate, which is fine. But there's real no agreement. There's very few people that are using a scientific method to analyze anything. I don't know why that's the case, except for the fact that science typically refers to this as not an issue. It's a pseudoscience to study something that really doesn't exist.
I have to agree with you there. I see my colleagues in this, in physics and astronomy, routinely throw out data. I belong to probably one of the best astronomy clubs on the East Coast, the Catawba Valley Astronomy Club. They have great equipment. They have very, very intelligent astronomers who work very well with the community, especially youth. But if you go to a night event where we're out in the middle of nowhere where there's very little light pollution, we have a couple of big telescopes set up and we're swinging around looking at different things. If you bring up the subject of UFOs, there are no fans among them. They will not hear of it. To them, there's no such thing and they don't want to hear it. And also, in my physics communities, those kinds of propulsions or stargates or wormholes, they're two firm camps. One believes that wormholes are possible and that they're even artificially possible, and the other community believes that they are not. We shall see when the super collider comes online, because we're going to fire some gold ions at each other at close to the speed of light for about a year,
right.
And some of them are going to hit each other. When they come apart, we're going to have some spectral information we've never had before. Some of that may be that black holes can and do exist.
Oh, yeah, and they don't have to be massive either. They could be as small as the nucleus of an atom, or maybe even smaller for all we know.
Well, we have built the LIGOs, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, and they are working in conjunction with one another around the planet. Washington State, Louisiana, Australia, Europe, and I think the LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, is due to be launched next year, which will give, which should give even better sensitivity. But we've got sensitivity down to, I believe, 10 to the minus 22 centimeters, which is a little bit smaller than a proton.
Mm-hmm.
But so far, no direct detection of black holes, only the coalescing neutron stars out there.
Well, I'm not surprised, Brooke, because, you know, although we, most people when they take physics, they talk about electrons quite a bit. But, in fact, that's part of atomic theory. We've never seen an electron. You can't quantify something that you can't really see. It's just a cloud of energy particles, quanta, flying around. And, you know, we've given a name, but we still don't know what it is.
Yeah, even when we chill them down and have a look at them, they appear to blink in and out
That's
of our
correct.
Dimension.
That's correct, because this is not the end-all and be-all of the universe. We're just a this is a, much like when you look, when we're looking at the wave spectrum from infrared to ultra-red radio frequency, our eyes really only see a sliver of the full spectrum.
Oh, sure.
And our machines, even our best machines, are starting to reach out to the edges. But that's, who's to say there isn't something even beyond that that we haven't been able to calibrate machines to? In other words, what if they are existing in other dimensions? Now, what are you going to do, build an interdimensional device?
Indeed.
If you do, that would be wonderful. But as far as I know, we don't have any of those.
Well, there is an interdimensional, what's being called a dimensional motor being tested at Sandia Labs, and they said that if they're successful with the tests, it will reduce the travel time from Earth to Mars to 3 hours and to the nearest star system to 8 days.
Well, I wish them luck with that. I mean, and I hope that we eventually get there someday, but I question whether or not we're mature enough to handle this kind of technology, because I know, like anything else, that it's the potential for abuse is great, especially in the hands of those who are corrupt.
Well, and especially in the hands of those who are busy funding weapons instead
right.
of peaceful intentions.
Yep. Unfortunately, that's part of our nature.
Well, we will discuss this more with our guest Robert Stanley when we come back after the break. And this is X Squared Radio, and I'm Brooks Agnew. Possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas, but the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high-priced days are now over.
If you click the 123 HS banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 HS, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, dust is a place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're going to open up the phone lines for the next 2 hours. Keep in mind, our program is on for 3 hours, so if your radio station's only playing part of that, you need to get those call letters to me. Just write me at info@x2-radio.com. Also, the phone lines in the U.S. toll-free. You can call 877-876-5227. Anywhere in Canada, we will also let you call toll-free, 888-810-8322. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can reach a tower, you can get to us at 530-876-3222. Right here on the BBS Radio Network with X Squared Radio. I also wanted to let you know I appreciate all the emails that you have sent me the last couple of weeks. As you know, last week we had Marine St. Germain on the program. Very excellent program. Tremendous host. And we are going to continue our corroboration with Ms. St. Germain. And try to work with her around the world if we can. Great things being done with Merkaba and with Living in the Heart, and also with my good friend Brunvalo Melchizedek. I also want to encourage you to visit NitroPack on our website. There is a banner for NitroPack. If you need food storage items, we highly recommend this company. They've been in business for over 18 years. They are the only affiliate, after my long stream of screening different food supply companies and emergency supplies companies, this is a company that I selected. Because of their integrity, because of their prices, because of the way they package their items and provide them to you, not just food, but everything that you might need in the form of emergency supplies, whether it's a year's supply of food for a single person or a family, or a 72-hour kit, this is the company to visit. So click on the NitroPack banner. Also, my good friend Brent Miller was on another major radio program that actually broadcasts over the airwaves last week, and he did a great job talking about the Horizon Project, and you heard the commercial for it. We want you to click on that Horizon Project banner ad at X Squared Radio. That's at x2-radio.com. That will take you to where you can buy the Horizon Project and other products put out by Intuitive Design. We encourage you to keep up with the latest current events on that research. We chose to release it that way. It is expensive for us to do, but that is the highest quality information that we could give you, and we chose that format. So we appreciate your patronage with that. Also, don't forget, this coming weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and there will be several after-convention events on Monday, is the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles. It'll be at the LAX Hilton. Not very much money to go there. Many of the greats will be there. Richard Hoagland will be there, among others. Stephen Greer is going to be there with a workshop. Dr. Nick Begich, my good friend, is going to be there. I will be speaking Sunday evening from 6 p.m. to 6:45. I'm doing it for free. It won't cost you a dime to come and hear. What am I going to speak about? I'm going to speak about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Now, you realize that we are doing this expedition for entertainment purposes only, officially. We are bringing film crews with us. We do intend to photograph everything if we can get it on film. Now, we're going to be doing side-scan sonar of the ocean floor. We're going to be doing some magnetism experiments and direct readings, great photography of the Aurora Borealis if it's there, wildlife, sea life, taking all kinds of samples. And you're going to be there with us. 100 people can go with us, and we are going to bring the data back to you. That documentary, if we see nothing but whales and icebergs, it's still going to be a great documentary about going to the North Pole because of the people that we're taking with us. But if we do see something, if we do catch on film UFOs moving underwater or coming out of the water or in the sky above us, or, as might be the metaphysical mission of the exploration team, to find an opening or evidence that there is some kind of, maybe even another dimension of existence in the inner Earth, it may well be the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world. We want you to be there. So come to the Conscious Life Expo. I'm going to make an hour-long, a 45-minute-long presentation on it. And I am, of course, all the time available to come to your hometown, your library, your convention center, your MUFON meetings, whatever you want me to come to, I will come and talk about this with your group. So just contact me. Reach me at biagnew@x2-radio.com. Or just Google my name, you'll find me out there. I'm here for you. That's why we're here at X Squared Radio. We have a caller on the line. Just hang on just 1 second. My guest tonight is Robert Stanley. He is the author of Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. He is the editor of Unicus Magazine. He's going to tell us how to get his book and how to contact him.
Well, thank you, Brooks. Yeah, my book is only available through my website. And Unicus is spelled UNICUS magazine.com. And I suggest that your listeners go there to read a free chapter. The first chapter is there, the entire chapter, not part of it, the teaser. The whole thing is there. And you'll also be able to see free images that come with the book. My book is the first UFO book that has a CD of 21 pages of pictures of UFOs, specifically related to Washington, D.C. So this should be very educational for people that are interested in learning something about the hidden history of the nation's capital.
All right, excellent, excellent. All right, caller, can we have your first name and what city you're calling from?
Hello?
Ah, yes, caller, your first name and the city you're calling
from.
Oh,
yeah, my name is Will Allen, and Robert Stanley and I are, in fact, working on the book that he's talking about. And I just wanted to let the folks know that the material that we photographed and documented at the U.S. Capitol is just a precursor for things to come. And I think folks in the nation's capital should be aware of that.
Wow.
But nevertheless, when you do get a chance, I want most of the listeners to go to www.ufodc.com. and look at the samples from the U.S. Capitol of the UFO that landed outside of the building itself.
Well, that's a website we're going to provide a link to from X Squared Radio, because that's going to be part of the archive when we put this up. We want this information to get out there. We don't have that many live listeners. We have a few thousand that come on live because it's Sunday night, and tonight I happen to be competing with the Super Bowl.
It's unfortunate.
We have a few hundred listeners out there who hate football, but even the ones who hate football want to see the commercials. So that's my competition tonight. A hard act to follow, to be sure.
I would have to disagree with that. I find it odd that people would think a game would be more important than something as substantial as a UFO landing.
Well, if we can get a UFO to land at the Super Bowl.
Well, that would be interesting, but, you know, that's not necessarily something that's probable to happen, you know.
Well, I can tell you there's a lot more intelligent life at a Super Bowl game than there is the White House. So
absolutely.
Probably.
Absolutely. And they're wearing cheerleader outfits.
So, Brooks, you know that Will is the D.C. photographer.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
yes.
He's the one. I know. I didn't mention his name. I was kind of waiting. I was to see if we could bring him on. But Will Allen is the D.C. photographer in the book. As mentioned in Chapter 1, he is the individual that took those pictures and had those experiences right there in the Capitol.
Well, this makes it even more remarkable that I can have on the program the man who actually shot the pictures. When you were looking through the viewfinder of your camera when you were taking these pictures, you didn't really expect to catch what you caught in the film.
When I looked through the viewfinder... keep in mind, as a photographer, you're conscious of everything that you see, because it all becomes part of the mix when it inevitably ends up as an image in the end result. And when I saw the object, my first instinct was to put it in perspective with a building or something that I could keep as a marker that would serve as a buoy, so to speak, to indicate its perspective in regards to where the object was with the building and where the camera was in relationship to the event. And no, it wasn't something that I expected to see, but it was odd to me that as I set the camera up, that this object was just sitting there quietly.
Wow. So did it appear or did it fly into the view?
It's hard to say, because I would say that during the course of taking the photograph, that as I set the camera up is one thing, and when I set the camera up and looked through the viewfinder and saw this object is another. When I pushed the exposure for the 3.5 minutes that I took the sample, what it did in the exposure, I did not see. I just saw the initial stages of the object as it was stationary above my head and as it flashed out. But what is registered on film is the entire course of events in that period of time as this object folded forward, generated a stargate, and left that area instantaneously.
Well, it's no wonder that jets can't follow it. If it's sliding into a stargate, there's no telling what area of space or even on the other side of our planet or inside.
It was curious, too, that in regards to the fact that this is a film sample, and when you start looking at film, film is a mechanical recreation, at least as close as possible to what the human eye can see, but it has some elements to it that are more remarkable than that of the human eye, in that it is able to see and record levels of light that are beyond the spectral range of the eye. And when it took the sample at Lower Senate Park, what it essentially saw was the energy from this object and the energy as it affected the air around this object as it moved forward. And it picked up a pattern which is indicative to digital photography, which looked like a series of blocks, which essentially was a temporal oscillation, which showed this oscillating pattern in an X, Y, Z perspective. It was oscillating in 3D. I'd never seen anything like that before, especially on a film sample, which is analog.
It looks like a fractal, Brooks. It looks like a fractal in the sky, where these, you know, it's not just ionization around the craft. It left an energy signature as these four craft created the wormhole. It created an energy signature in the sky that is like a giant fractal in the sky.
And it left this energy signature embedded on the film. Using a film scanner, and I'm using Nikon CoolScan technology at 4,000 DPI, scanning this film in high definition, it allowed me to see more than met the eye. And what it saw was this stargate, this arc of matter in the sky, where this object entered into this matter and vanished as if it went from another point of dimension in this time to another dimension in another time. It was absolutely abstract.
Do you have your camera on motor drive at this time? You're snapping as many pictures as your camera can take at that
moment? Well, no, in this particular case, this was what's called a duration image, and I used a standard reading of the actual area based on the conditions, which, for example, if you're into photography, at a certain point it requires you have additional stability on the camera in order to capture an image. In this particular case, I shut my aperture down to maximize the focus range of the actual image itself. So what I have is a high-definition sample within a range which is in focus of this anomalous object. Now, in this exposure, in the 3.5 minutes, again, this object appeared in the sky in multiple locations. It dematerialized, rematerialized, dematerialized, rematerialized, generated the stargate, then vanished.
Wow. And all that happened in one exposure.
It was a 3.5 minute exposure, though.
Yeah,
I'm sorry?
Exactly.
The 3.5 minutes is how long he had the shutter open on the camera, though.
That would be 3.5 minutes. That's equivalent to 360 seconds.
Wow. So how far away would you say you were from the anomaly itself?
The anomaly, I would say, was 50 yards above my head. About 150 feet up.
Yeah, but Brooks, when you look closely at the full picture that he took, you can see there's other things hovering nearby. I mean, really, literally, just above the grass, in the trees.
Oh, there are objects landing. There are objects in the trees. It's just a very unusual photograph. Essentially, what it shows is multiple landings. It shows an object above my head. It shows an object already on the ground in Taft Park, which Rob Simone and I went into that area and found the area where it landed. And it's an extremely unusual photograph in the sense that it is not what you expect to see or find next to the U.S. Capitol in restricted airspace.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. But
oh, my man, it's absolutely bizarre to walk into an extraterrestrial event at the U.S. Capitol. That's the last place you think anything like that would happen.
Well, that close to it, when it's going through these plasma manipulations, did you feel anything?
Well, is he still there?
I'm still here. I'm
what did you feel?
My,
okay,
my volume on my phone is not very well here.
Okay.
Did you feel something in the air? I mean, as that close to something, I would think you would have felt static electricity in your hair.
I can't explain it. It felt like water, but it was not wet. And shortly afterwards, my arms were energized. And then about a week after that, these radiant burns appeared on all of my fingernails, which looked like I had been bombarded with a laser beam of some sort. I had to go to NIH and have these gradient burns analyzed, and the cellular biologist, Dr. Bonet, that looked at these burns was unable to conclude how I received this level of cellular decay, which, by the way, there were green crystals coming out of my fingers. I put some crystals in a test tube and sealed it. By the time I took that test tube to the hospital, those crystals vanished.
Well, they probably sublimated inside the test tube.
They were solid, looked like green crystals of salt.
Did you have quite a bit
of them. And enough of it not to evaporate over a course of 11 hours. And in 11 hours, when I took that test tube to NIH, those crystals were gone.
Did they do a headspace analysis of that test?
They did a biopsy of the tissue from my fingers, and she was just unable to determine that level of cellular decay. It was completely burned, but not burned like a third-degree burn, more like charred burned.
Wow. Well, that is... That's amazing.
It's on my website. She allowed me to record a statement on her assessment of the analysis of my hands. And it also further substantiates the documentation in the sense that whatever this object was, it utilized a level of energy that was, I would say, in a nuclear range, because it would require nuclear energy to substantially be in a position to stay stationary like that. We have no Harrier or collective pitch technology that would allow an aircraft to be absolutely 100% stationary as this object was above my head and center part.
Yeah, a Harrier makes a whole bunch of noise.
Absolutely. This thing made no noise at all. In fact, the entire area was mute.
Yeah, I remember you told me that there was no sound at all, practically, and you said
it
not
was
even
mute.
The water
was
splashing.
It was weird in the sense here's a reflection pool, and in the reflection pool it ducks and indigenous wildlife, but in that instant there was absolutely no noise.
You know, Brooks, he did take a series of photographs in front of the Capitol Dome, and then when he was done there, he went and walked to the Senate side of the Capitol, to lower Senate Park, and took that final time exposure. But the series of shots he took right in front of the Capitol building there at the reflecting pool, it shows not only did the object, one of the objects, land next to the Capitol Dome house side, but then the next frame, it literally shows that same object is now airborne and in motion.
And an additional set of green anomalous objects landing in the rear of Reflection Pool Park on film.
I have a friend in Washington, D.C. I don't want to use her name, but her father has relayed to me three sightings in the last month and a half in the Washington, D.C. area. It does seem to be kind of a real hot spot even now for sightings and for this kind of activity.
Hey, Brooks, I would really like to get, it can be anonymous, but if you can send me forward some of that information, because even though I stopped at 224, I'm still collecting the database for further updates for people as the information comes in.
I would be happy to send that to you. I will ask my friend in D.C. for permission to do that. I'm sure that she'll grant it, because it is she who suggested I interview you on this program.
Oh, has she read my book, do you know?
That I don't know.
I don't know.
I do know that that you had sent her some photographs, and I really don't want to use
it. That's fine. I understand completely.
Okay.
You know, Will also accidentally, when he was, he tapes a lot of different information coming to his home, and he accidentally captured a Fox News in D.C., was doing a live broadcast of an event at the Capitol. Wasn't it September 7th, Will? Something like that?
I believe it was in September. Exactly.
September 4th. Anyways, it was Labor Day 2006. They went to B-roll of the Capitol building. The story was this, Brooks. They said, Senate is now back in session for Labor Day, and it was like 10 o'clock at night. And they're saying they're convening a special session for whatever it was, like a minimum wage or something like that. So they cut to the B-roll, right, the live video feed of the Capitol building. Well, guess what's over the Capitol Dome? Okay? That was
green anomalies. And, you know, they're denying, and one of the things I've got to mention is we developed a technology not so long ago that would inhibit people with digital video or digital still cameras from taking photographs. Now, if we have this technology, wouldn't it be logical that a superior intelligence would have something similar to that that would make their objects or their visibility impervious to our level of technology? I believe so. When I showed my sample to the U.S. Capitol Police Detective Division, they made a comparative analysis of their footage and my footage, and ironically, their footage showed absolutely nothing. And why is that? Well, they're using digital technology, while this film sample, which is not susceptible to pixels or anything of that nature, captured this energy source and captured it on a film emulsion, which is sensitized to light. So it's a different technology here. So it's obvious that this extraterrestrial intelligence has a technology which not only makes them impervious to our eyes, but impervious to digital camera technology.
Right, right. Well, whenever I travel, and I'm going on a photo shoot for one of my books in the next few weeks, I always take digital and I take a regular 35mm camera.
Absolutely. And even in the case, if, for example, you're using a 35mm technology like I'm using the F5 and the F100 Nikon, they use microprocessors. If you're subjected to EMP, that camera is useless.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and
regardless of the fact
that
it's
an electronic camera.
So whatever this object was above my head at the U.S. Capitol, it did not use magnetic energy, because if that was the case, it would have shut down the microprocessor in the camera during the exposure.
Wow.
It did not do that.
Unless they really wanted you to capture
the Unless they wanted me to capture this. And the whole event at the U.S. Capitol seemed staged. It looks like these things posed for these photographs and smiled.
Well, that's what I was asking. Yeah, that's what I was asking Robert earlier, was since you have been sort of initiated into this?
When I was a child, my father was stationed at a base in England called Scunthorpe, which is right next to Lake and Heath in Rendlesham. And you know what happened at Rendlesham? Well, yeah. Let me tell you what happened at Scunthorpe. A UFO landed, and extraterrestrials came into my room as a child. So I saw them.
Well, that's more than I can remember from my childhood, and I don't know if I had those kinds of experiences, but as I was saying, you've been kind of initiated into...
Yeah, it seems to go without saying, in the sense that for the time that I was growing up, especially on military bases, the difficulty that I had explaining to people what I encountered as a child, and not thinking that the repercussions of that... in the military system, for example, when I told my third grade teacher what I saw at McGuire Air Force Base, they put me in special ed, which, by the way, I'm working on my PhD now, so I'm the product of special ed. So I have this issue with these individuals that responded to my claims with, how should I say, I can't put a name on it, but they acted improperly on my claims of being contacted by extraterrestrials as a child.
You know, what's important about what he's saying here, Brooks, is that this is one of the reasons he was motivated to try and find evidence, much like Daryl Sims has been motivated most of his life.
Absolutely.
To try and find some way to prove to people that this is not some aberration or mental disorder or whatever.
Absolutely. They want you to think that this is a psychological disorder, and they treat you as if you have a psychological disorder. But I saw extraterrestrials as a child. It did not mean they warranted putting me in a school for mentally disabled individuals, which they did. And this is military, DOD.
Well, I know exactly what you're going through, and that's why X Squared Radio was formed, because there was not, I think there used to be a way for this information to get out, but it got so commercialized, it got so wrapped up in selling commercials and making money for so many people. And
absolutely.
It lost its way.
Well, you know, I was with a friend of mine, Dr. Bellamy. He's one of the deans at Georgetown Law School. And we were at a bar, and we started drinking, and he had to get me somewhat nice, so to speak, to discuss the implications of my photographs and the possibility that these photographs will destabilize society. Well, my opinion is society is already destabilized.
Yeah, we're split into this dichotomy. We have people who believe in UFOs, and when I do my man on the street interviews, I ask people, "Do you believe in UFOs?" And or they'll ask me, "You don't believe in UFOs, do you?" And I'll turn around and ask them, "You don't believe we're alone in the universe, do you?"
Well, you know, I've got to say, regardless, even with tangible, documented facts like I have, I can go places, talk about the subject, and be the butt of a joke.
Yeah, well, it is a very polarizing subject. It is one that people will say, "Oh, well, the guy's crazy," or "Oh, gee, not another one," or
"Oh, absolutely, all of the above.
How come I didn't get to see that?"
But you know, Brooke, here's the problem: even if somebody does see it, what are they supposed to conclude? Because officially, these things don't exist, and unofficially. What you just said about do you believe, well, you know, as a scientist, you know that the scientific process is not about belief.
That's
it's
right.
About observation that's
yeah.
been verified, right?
I don't believe in chemistry.
Okay, exactly, because it's been established as a fact. As close as we can get to anything as reality, we use the scientific method for a reason on everything except this kind of UFO stuff. There's a political hot potato here that nobody. It's a white elephant in the room that nobody wants to address.
It's very odd that it is fine to talk about Obi-Wan Kenobi, Chewbacca, E.T. Phone Home, Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, but when you start talking about the real deal, it's taboo.
Yeah, that is kind of funny. I do a really good Chewbacca imitation, by the way.
But that's strange. These are fictitious characters, and you accept that, but you make a joke of a fact?
No, I'm just saying I do a really good Chewbacca imitation.
But I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the people that I encounter.
It's strange. I'm just saying that you're right. We spend gazillions of dollars trying to get as close as we can to what? The real thing?
Exactly. We're being essentially psychologically trained to accept the possibility that extraterrestrials are real, but yet we will not affirm the fact that they do exist.
Well, we are here, and the circles that I travel in, and I got to tell you, you have to make your way up to James Gilliland's retreat up in Trout Lake. That, oh man, what a hotbed of ET activity. I was 51 years old when I went there, and I had my first ET experience, and I was delighted. It scared the crap out of me the first time it happened, but it was a stimulus response type of activity. I wasn't sitting there as a passive observer. We interacted with it with lasers and with our emotions, and it responded.
Yep.
And that was a direct observation, a fact, which I now have in my memory base, and I have reported in writing, and I have reported it on this program and others. That was now, you know, when we talk about religion, we talk about faith. Do you have faith that God exists? Do you have faith that Jesus lived? All of these things. Yes, indeed. But once you know, faith is no longer needed. And we might have had a belief at one time that chemistry operated, or that the principles of physics or geology operated. But now we have direct observation. We've done experiments, and we've proved them out. And now we have knowledge, so we no longer have to have belief.
Absolutely. And with these encounters also comes concepts that are contradictory to our level of technology. My sample in the, for example, on Lower Senate Park, shows a green object moving lateral and upwards. Now, according to the light laws of light in motion in physics, a green object is supposed to leave a lateral green light and a lateral upwards light. This object left a blue light going one direction and a green light going another. So that negated the laws of light in motion. So it allows you to think another level of thought that is outside what we would consider normal or normal physics. Normal physics does not apply to extraterrestrial technology.
Well, you're absolutely right. I had Dr. Jim Bell on here last month. He's the leader of the rover programs that operate on Mars, the Opportunity and Spirit rovers. And he mentioned that the drawback was bandwidth in getting the information from the rovers up to the orbiter, and then the orbiter had to amplify them and then beam them to Earth. And so to get instructions and information back and forth to the rovers took some time. And I said, well, what you really need is the beryllium ion modem. And he said, what is that? I said, well, you've heard of entangled particles, haven't you? And he said, well, no, not really. It's amazing, PhDs, how much they know about so little. And I said, well, right now there are 6 beryllium ions in a satellite speeding toward the outer part of our galaxy and our solar system. And they are interacting with their environment. And when those particles change spin, the entangled counterparts here on Earth change spin instantaneously.
Wow.
So we are talking about a binary change that is not affected by distance.
Or time.
Right. This was first tested in, earlier, of course, the entangled particle theory is very solid, but in 1999, 2 particles were separated by 11 kilometers, and it still worked. We're not talking about across a lab now. We're talking 11 kilometers. So what we have here is the makings for remote sensing and remote communication across vast distances instantaneously. Well, it's so funny that they don't put 2 and 2 together, because if these particles can be entangled that way, then energy can be entangled that way, and then consciousness can be entangled that way. And all it just does not take that much of an intuitive mind to figure out that not only are we not alone in the universe, we're probably not the only humans in the universe.
Definitely not.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And what I believe I saw at the U.S. Capitol was a life form without a body. It was energy. They were energy. And it's strange that I would be able to capture this energy in 2 separate images, with a definitive shape, which I was easy to find similarities in both of these objects in two different photographs at the U.S. Capitol. What I saw was this luminous energy, which was translucent but yet impervious to analysis, and they were coming at me.
Well, now I'm going to ask you a question. I was exposed to this last August, the first time in my life. A person that I met, who is now a friend, his name is Mikhail Ledwith. He's, by and large, one of the best speakers I've ever heard, a former Catholic priest, former chairman of the Divinity School. He has become the consummate orb photographer. I just wanted to ask you if you have ever photographed orbs and what you think.
I photographed what they consider... Well, I can't say that. Well, I've got two samples. There's a sample on my website, which was taken November of 2002, which has a perfectly small sphere the size of a marble above a lady's head. But then I have a sample that I took at an Ethiopian wedding, which showed spheres of light, but not with the structure of this UFO anomaly, but more translucent, more spiritual-type orb, and lots of them in a room with a few people during a wedding. So I've got 140 samples of sphere anomalies going through this room in a wedding, and one sample of this micro-anomaly on the street of Washington, D.C., which was 100% different than these objects I photographed at this wedding. So there is the possibility that paranormal energy and paranormal entities do exist, along with the possibility of extraterrestrial entities and beings existing, all in the same plane.
Well, there's one other possibility, too, from what I understand, is that they have a technology that allows solid objects to become dissipated. So in other words, if you're going to move in between dimensions, like if they want to come in the room, they don't have to knock on the door. They can literally go through the wall by separating the atoms just enough so that they don't collide.
Exactly, what I saw in my house not so long ago with that smaller object that ran through the room.
I have a picture a series of pictures someone took. They're a spelunker, and they'd gone down into a cave which was open vertically, so they had to rappel down inside of it. So the sunlight came down into the cave, but it quickly dissipated, and so it was light down there, but there weren't shafts of light coming down in the cave. And he took a series of motor drive shots of his fellow spelunkers down in the bottom, and he sent me the photographs because what appeared to them were a series of orbs, I guess about a dozen of them, and they traveled not in one direction, but in several directions.
Multidirectional, exactly.
And went through the walls of the rock. So you have them appearing above these fellows' heads, and then they're going off to the right and the left without the camera moving. One shot after the other, these things go through the wall, and one of the shots, one of the orbs, is halfway into the rock.
Wow.
Well, it's interesting, too, that in the sample that I took at this Ethiopian wedding, these spherical anomalies had structure. And when I compared several of these anomalies, the larger ones that were more apparent in the photographs, the structure within these anomalies were exactly the same. It could possibly mean that this was the same anomaly photographed several times during the course of the evening. But my point being, whatever these anomalies are, they have a structure.
I couldn't agree with you more. I had a shot that was taken actually over my head at James's ranch. In this shot, there are about, I don't know, I'm going to say 100 or so orbs, different sizes, different colors. We took the shot with a 10-megapixel camera, took it back inside, blew it up on the wall in the meeting hall where these orbs were about 4 feet across. And the structure inside these orbs was each unique.
Circles within circles.
Oh, they were, well, they look like schematics. And
well, one sample I have here, and it was ironic, I was with K.B. Morgan, and he was doing one of the samples he did of Mars and the polar ice cap of Mars, and one of my spheres at this Ethiopian wedding looks exactly like the polar ice cap of Mars.
How about that?
when I say exactly, I mean exactly like the polar ice cap of Mars.
Well, I've seen them with faces, with beards, with horses in them, with what looks like a Mayan calendar, and another one that looked like a kaleidoscope, all kinds of different triangles.
Exactly. They have this pattern within them, and there, within the pattern is a structure which is unique possibly to some form of geometry or mathematics, but nevertheless, it shows a definitive structure to an anomaly which in theory should not exist.
Well, let's talk a moment for about what why they're here. I call them mind sweepers because I think they're here collecting data in swarms and then sending that information back to wherever it needs to go. And I think that it's possible you might be seeing a bleed back of other information that's being either stored in these devices or broadcast back to the devices, but they're here to collect information. In my estimation, I think that's what they do. So it makes sense you'd see a different thing.
You might be right because, well, I'm going to share this experiment with you. I hope you don't. I don't want to sound way out there, but this experiment I witnessed. I was sitting in a lawn chair and I watched it. Michael went out and said, I'm going to demonstrate to you that these are not dust particles or bugs or anything like that. He set his camera up on a tripod about 5 feet up on the ground, set it to take four photographs, 10 seconds, about 15 seconds apart.
Mm-hmm.
He went out into the echinacea field, which was in front of us, and there was nothing but him. And we were sitting around him maybe 40 or 50 feet away from him on three sides. He stood there for the first shot, which flashed, and then he raised his arms above his head, and another flash went off, and then he put his arms out like a T, straight out from his shoulders, took another flash, and he put his arms back down, and then one more flash. And then we looked at the photographs. In the first one, when it went off, it was just him and blackness. There was no moon that night. It was just all dark around him. In the second one, he had raised his arms up, and he said that he sort of drew up his consciousness in him and pushed out a feeling of love to everyone around him. And above his head was a swirl of what looked like white smoke. And in the smoke were dozens of these orbs.
Wow. Exactly. Smaller anomalies.
Put his arms out like a T. The number of orbs went up to about 100, and the smoke began to dissipate. When he had his arms back down at his side, there were about 5 left, and that was it. So it was about a 50-second cycle of these orbs appearing and then disappearing. And they focused on, or he said, they focused on his emanence of a feeling of love to those people around him. Love drew them in.
Well, you know, it's funny. In most of the samples, especially the UFO samples and some of my samples from this Ethiopian wedding, to some of the people who call themselves the so-called experts in photography, they always come to this conclusion that it is a pixelation issue, that is an issue with the optics. And my point is, if it is a pixelation issue and an issue with the optics, then those distortions would be apparent throughout all the photographs that you take,
exactly.
Which is not the case. And you have samples here which show these anomalies. How do you explain them off as a distortion or as an abnormality in the film or an error in processing or a problem in pixelation when in actuality it is an anomaly that is not visible to the eye but perceptible to this level of technology in these cameras?
I don't have an answer to that. I'm not an expert photographer, but I'm saying I witnessed this occur, that no one touched the camera, and no one was stirring up dust, and nobody threw...
And the point being, it was not something that was a problem or an issue with your camera that would cause that distortion to appear.
Exactly.
That was not the case. But
exactly.
It's always assumed that it is the camera or an issue with the pixels or the optics that caused these anomalies to be photographed in your images. No one ever wants to take the opinion that whatever these anomalies are, they are real and not some aberration or distortion based on a technological flaw in your camera.
Well, there's also eyewitness reports, though, of people actually seeing them with their physical eyes.
Exactly.
Sure. And the book by Jim Sparks has been causing quite a controversy lately, called The Keepers. And I just reviewed that book for the press, for the publisher. And he talks in there about sitting in his living room and suddenly feeling a buildup of static electricity around his body. And then three marble-sized green spheres just appeared in his living room. And I won't bore you with the rest of the stuff that happened, but I'm just saying they're part of the phenomena with regarding UFOs and aliens. This is part of their technology. Yeah,
I would have to believe so, because whatever these anomalies are, they are not consistent with anything in our text of history. There's nothing recorded in history that would describe small spheres or miniature UFOs or these glowing orbs of light that go through rooms. Nowhere in history is anything like that documented.
Well, yeah,
but there is this influx of UFO activity, which could be directly related to these anomalies.
No, there are quite a few historical records of that occurring long before cameras were ever even available, of red flashing orbs that have led ships who were lost out in the ocean.
Exactly.
And there are not a few paintings of orbs and craft in the sky above cities and above important people, which date back to the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Well, I understand what Will's saying. We don't have, until recently, we didn't have this technology, and in the past we would have considered it as not even as being a technology. It would have, if anything, it was a spirit or an angel or...
Exactly.
You know, Something like that.
We took more spiritual and metaphysical philosophies towards a possibility of these anomalies being of extraterrestrial origin.
Yeah, like a ghost or something
exactly.
like that, but not necessarily a technological being.
But then, too, in my levels of photography and doing some work that I've done in graveyards, I've sampled anomalies in graveyards that I have to question also in terms of how a possibility of such could exist, but it's nevertheless something that exists, and it exists beyond the reference of our eyes.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, our eyes only pick
see
up very,
so much
very narrow wavelengths of light.
Exactly, and what the eye does not see, and in the Bible it says, "To fear not what you see, but what you do not see."
Well, I don't want to fear anything.
I don't fear anything either, but it is interesting that they would make that point. And what you do not see is things in the infrared range, in which most UFOs appear in the infrared range, and these anomalies, which, strangely enough, when you notice, you take a photograph of these spheres, prior to taking the photograph, an infrared beam is shot out, which is part of the focus mechanism of these digital cameras. That infrared beam illuminates these anomalies.
Ah, I see. That's how they sense distance. And
absolutely. When you
focus.
Think about it, they only appear, too, when a flash does go off. And part of these digital camera technologies is that they use an infrared focusing technology that focuses a beam of infrared on the subject. The beam is reflected back into the camera, and the camera focuses on that information. When that infrared beam is shot out, these anomalies are illuminated.
I agree with you. I have taken orb photography with no flash, just using the focusing mechanism of the digital camera itself, and the orbs do show up.
They would show up?
Yes, I do have pictures with no flash.
Interesting.
Yeah,
then the camera is still picking up a level of light that the eye does not see.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Well, actually, the reason I took the shot is because the guy that was sitting next to me said, "You need to take a shot of that wall right now. There's an orb sitting right on that wall." I said, "I don't see it." He said, "Take your shot. No flash. You'll get it." And it was there.
It's interesting. In the sample I did at this wedding, this orb was on this one person's back. And in the next frame, this guy is taking the jacket off his back, and the orb is moved to another position in the room. And I started to wonder, what was it that made that man take his jacket off in the very next frame? Was it the fact that he felt this anomaly on his back? And I would have to send you a sample for you to understand this particular application. But the samples at this wedding clearly show that these anomalies do exist, that they do have physical structure, and they travel throughout the frame of an image.
And they're intelligent.
And they're intelligent.
Whether it's artificial intelligence or not, you can't. We really can't distinguish.
It's intelligent regardless.
Wow.
Well, you know, the Navy has been developing something like that. It's called Swarm, where you send out a bunch of mini-bots, and they fly through the air, and individually they have just tiny little collectors for data. But collectively, they combined all that data. You can get a three-dimensional image of the terrain that they're in and collect all kinds of intelligence that way.
Well, you know, essentially, if you look at where we're going in terms of nanotechnology, it is not far to comprehend the possibility of creating a microscopic device with a video camera and the capability of doing a full-length motion picture and bringing that information back and storing that information. This level of technology, it's growing to the point where size is no longer relevant in terms of information that is stored.
Right. Right. Alan, can you hang with us for a little bit more?
Absolutely.
All right. We will come back right after this break. I have to take a commercial break. And we'll be back in about 6 minutes.
I'll be here.
Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. I have Alan Wills, I think it is.
Will Allen.
Will Allen, I'm sorry. And Robert Stanley on with me on X Squared Radio. We'll be back. Possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas. But the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high price days are now over. If you click the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 inkjet, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, that's the case for the past and the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Wave Radio.
Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysm. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Hundreds of Many Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I actually have two guests on right now. I have Robert Stanley, who's the author of a great book called Close Encounters on Capitol Hill, for which some of the content was contributed by, and I think was the instigator of the book, Will Allen, the actual photographer or photographer that took the pictures for the book. And I'm happy to have both of you on. I know that at the studio, we can't take any phone calls because Will is on the phone, but I don't want to get rid of him right now. He's so good at providing the content to us, and I want you to stay a little bit longer if you can.
I think he's still there. Brooks, you know what? Wait till you guys see the DVD that Will has put together, because you know, obviously working for ABC, he's got a lot of skills when it comes to editing graphics together. And he has done a superb job, taking quite some time, but that'll be
released. Absolutely. I rendered my still images in Avid HD, and the translation from still to video was extraordinary. It is, in fact, I have to say, a very compelling piece of video evidence that further substantiates this documentation.
Well, are you you have someone available to air these this DVD?
I was working with a deal with this material on Discovery, But they recently found that it was a little bit too graphic, if that is the term. So I'm looking at History Channel, and Rob Simone, with Discovery Channel, ironically, came to town and filmed some footage on this material and was able to find one of the original radar witnesses of the 1952 event, which took place in the same location at the U.S. Capitol.
So I guess what we're saying is we're going to see a much better documentary than what we saw in 60 Minutes.
What I've got, I have to say, is some extraordinary footage. Extraordinary is an understatement.
Well, here's the reason I was mentioning it, Will and Brooks, is because I really believe, although I wrote a pretty good book about this, the bottom line is most people don't read these kind of books, and they tend to get their information from the television set.
Or the National Enquirer.
Whatever. But the bottom line is that people need to see this visually in order to comprehend what we're talking about, and that's why I suggest they either go to my website or Will's website and take a look at the free pictures that are posted there and start to consider this is a matter of national security. I'm a patriotic American, and I know Will is also.
Absolutely.
And we both feel that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, even if we don't have military parity with these beings. The fact of the matter is they keep visiting us covertly, and we're leaving the door wide open for them, and just hoping to God that they have that they're benevolent.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, none of my encounters were ever violent. It was just the fact that, you know, the sight of something that is different, that is something that, you know, you start to wonder, and that's the element that does get you scared.
Yeah.
But outside of that, none of the encounters were ever violent or painful or anything of that nature. In fact, every time I encountered these anomalies, I always left with some knowledge.
Will, what was your website again?
My website is www.ufodc.com. That's UFO David Charlie. com.
All right. Well, I want to make sure to put a link, if you don't mind, Robert.
Yeah, please do.
And, of course, there's www.unicusmagazine.com also.
Right. Yeah, we're linked up.
Yep.
We have substantial material that it just further adds the icing to the cake on top of this visual documentation that I have.
Well, I encourage people to go to unicusmagazine.com, read that sample chapter, the first chapter of the book.
Absolutely.
It is only 26 pages, but I promise you when you finish it, you're going to want to buy the book.
Absolutely.
I already want the book. I
and the DVD.
And hey, I only got one chapter. I want the whole book.
Well, so, Brooks, do you want me to send it to you? Because by the time I send it to you, you're going to be here in L.A. Could I just hand you a copy while you're here?
I want to. That's the way I want
that to. Will work. That will work. And, Robert, I'll make sure you have the material you need to get.
I'll be there the whole week. I don't have a booth.
Okay.
I'm just going there to speak on Sunday evening. But I'm going to be there the whole weekend.
Okay.
So I'll be the guy with the backpack selling books out of out of my backpack.
And good deal.
By the way, our number one competition tonight is the Super Bowl. And I know people Monday will hit the archives like crazy. Halftime, Indianapolis Colts 16, Chicago Bears 14.
All right.
But I'm sure that's going to turn around because the Bears.
Well, I'm glad it's something that people do enjoy, and, you know, that's what most people do when they have idle time.
Yeah.
And what does one do when they're doing nothing? Just waste it in front of a boob tube.
Well, more and more people are going to the Internet now than ever, and talk radio, to get information and entertainment, and that's really good, I think, because there's less restrictions on what we can discuss. And this is, you know, honestly, guys, this is still the most taboo subject on the planet.
But my point still is, the Super Bowl having precedence over something as astronomical as a UFO sighting, such as the sighting at Chicago or as this material at the U.S. Capitol. I just find it odd. People are more interested in the game than the news.
Well, this can't be real news, though, Will, because it's officially it never happened.
Well,
unfortunately. Look, I'm just pointing out
And that's
the
way they're treating it. It's funny. Guys, don't laugh, but I'm being treated here as if I just escaped from maximum security at Fort Leavenworth. You know, and it makes me feel like, is it me, or is this material so abstract that the normal person just does not want to believe it?
No, I don't think it's that at all. And, you know, Monday morning, we start a week-long deluge on our website to listen to these archives, and about 12 million people access them before next Sunday.
Wow.
That's a lot of people that come in, will listen to this interview, and they'll go to these websites, and they'll be picking up your information.
Well, I appreciate it. I really commend you, Brooks, for what you're doing. I was browsing your website. You got a lot of really good information up there, and it does take courage. I want people to know that it's not easy, because that's why a lot of the media people won't do this kind of story, because they feel it'll ruin their credibility or their reputation. And it's kind of sad, because their job really is to report the news, not to censor it.
Well, you know, in that point too, Robert, it was essential that in the presentation I put on my website that I established the fact that I'm a professional photographer, and that I also established the fact that the equipment was not flawed, in the sense that these anomalies did not show up in any other photograph on any other roll of film I ever shot through this technology.
Right.
It was essential that I do that, and people will still nevertheless not believe that documentation.
Well, you said that magic word again, though. See, we're treating this collectively. Our society treats this as though it's a religion, that you can believe it or not depending on your mood, and that's not the case, and we shouldn't be doing that. But, you know, here's the thing. The other part of the equation is we haven't officially or unofficially welcomed these beings to visit us. And that's why if you go to my website, you'll see one of the links there is called Cosmic Concert. And what I propose that not only are we going to throw an event to sort of promote it, so to get people aware of it, to get the mainstream media to cover this event, but what we're going to do is we're going to have artists and authors at this concert. And they're going to present the best evidence that we are being visited by intelligent life forms other than human on this planet right now.
Oh, I definitely want to be part of that event.
Well, but here's the upshot, Brooks. We're going to ask everybody, we're going to invite everybody on the planet that wants to vote electronically through the website as to the one question: should benevolent extraterrestrials be welcome to visit Earth, yes or no? You see, that kind of global democracy has never been attempted before, and it may seem rather benign, but I guarantee you there's some people just doing that. They're going to be heavily opposed to it.
Well, you might be right. I know in putting together the North Pole Inter-Earth Expedition, it's not that I've come across opposition. I have come across a little indifference. I have come across a pretty silent media out there. You would think, well, I'll put it this way. My name has been mentioned more on Coast to Coast in the last 3 weeks than it has in the last 2 years on that program.
Mm-hmm.
But getting on the program to tell about the expedition has been impossible. I haven't been on it in over 2 years. So that's just something that occurs. Now, I'm not going to get on the, you know, mainstream media, obviously, even after we pull the expedition off and we come back with, you know, hours and hours, hundreds of hours of film and data, we're still not going to get the kind of publicity
regardless of the fact that you could come back with a ton of data that substantiates everything that you claim. It's not going to make people change their perception of this subject. They're indoctrinated. They're brainwashed in believing that you don't want to talk about this. I see no evil. I hear no evil. I say no evil.
I like Robert's independent democratic poll, though. Let people vote. And if there is, even if there's not a consensus, even if only 30% of the people want to be introduced to the galactic community, that is a significant number.
Yeah, and it's the first step towards doing what I think the good guys are already doing, which is they have a global, democratic, utopian form of government where everybody gets an equal say in any issue, especially when it affects everybody's future like that. You see, look, I don't think we should ask permission. Disclosure is fine. I don't think it'll ever happen, and if it does, it's not going to be. They're not going to tell us 100% of the truth because
never.
It's embarrassing.
Absolutely not. They'll never fess up to any of their wrongdoings because there's a level of acceptability that they don't want people to have, you know, and it's ironic that it's like that.
Hey, well, speaking of Coast to Coast, when I was on in December, right after the show, my website was hacked into by a company in Virginia, and they took down the pictures of the UFOs landing on the Capitol, and they locked me out of my website so I couldn't fix it. All right, now, that clearly shows that somebody's upset by this. Now, to go back a year previous to that, when I first released the first article and some of the photographs internationally through Nexus magazine, who are good friends of mine, and also through my own Unicus magazine, I had a visit from a black helicopter, and it didn't just fly over my house. The damn thing was hovering over my house, and I've got two pictures in the book. I've got one picture on the website. People can see this is a black unmarked helicopter flying below 300 feet in a quiet residential neighborhood. I mean, the thing was really literally over my house and shaking the whole house. It was so loud and so low. Now, why would they do that unless they were obviously upset by what I was doing?
Well, obviously, it's affecting me the same way in the sense that, you know, I'm a degreed engineer, and I worked in the White House, and I've got all this information and this technology, but yet no one wants to touch or use me in any of their projects. Why is that?
Well, I want you to come on the North Pole Inter-Earth Expedition with me.
I would definitely love to do that because I have a technology I'm dying to use on the North Pole.
See, Brooks, what he hasn't explained yet is that Will's got a formula for taking pictures in damn near pitch black dark.
Essentially, full color night vision.
It's amazing. I've never seen anything like it.
In extreme negative EV.
Wow. Now, we might need to do that. Now, originally, we had planned to go in July of this year. Logistics and funding look like it's not going to make it in July. But the further we push it out in the year...
Yeah, the weather gets worse.
Well, it's not necessarily the weather. It's still pretty mild up there now.
Yeah.
It's you know, 3 degrees, but that's not really that terrible. It's the light. It's this
time of year. Yeah, it gets dark up there. That's right.
There's 20 hours of darkness.
That's true.
It's dark to the human eye.
Yeah.
It's dark to the human eye, but I guarantee you, it is not dark.
Right. Well, that, you know, I don't mind going in October or November even.
I wouldn't mind going in total darkness, honestly, because this technology is extraordinary. When I say high-definition night vision in full color, that's what I get in total darkness.
He's got some examples of that on his website. You can't even imagine that he took a picture standing in the trees in a park in the dark, and the Capitol building is, like, glowing like it's daytime, but sort of like in a fairy world. It's like, it's a level of light that we've never seen before. Very subtle, but it's profound.
I'm using a technology which is analog and essentially chemistry, and I was able to modify the film in development by doing a subtle change in the first level of development, which I will not mention because it is part of my patent. But nevertheless, in this modification, it allowed me to essentially excite the emulsion of the film and generate light levels that were not necessarily there initially during the actual exposure. And the technology works, and it works in full color.
Well, I just wanted to really quickly share my black helicopter story with you.
I
had been invited to speak down in Memphis at a public library, and that was announced on the web and announced at various outlets. And so people knew I was coming. As soon as we turned onto the off-ramp to go there, 4 black helicopters with the little ball above them, you know, the little sensor helicopter,
yeah.
the radar,
mm-hmm.
4 of them came over me.
Wow.
I thought, well, gee, you know, here I am in my little Suzuki SUV, not broadcasting anything. Okay, I was talking on the cell phone. In fact, I did talk on the cell phone all the way down there, so they probably tracked me. But I'm not a paranoid type. They haven't done anything to me that I know of. I broadcast from deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky, a rather ignominious little town, and I don't feel threatened. But
well, let's just say you're not intimidated by the subtleness of these objects just appearing.
Well, I feel a little stonewalled, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I think we all do. It gets very frustrating to all of us that deal in this type of information because the level of receptivity is extremely low.
And it's not just low. It's almost asinine in the sense that most people, when you make the presentation known, they make jokes of it. What is funny about this?
Well, it makes them nervous. Okay, let's be honest here. Brutally honest is that most people are paranoid of anything that they don't understand, and this represents the unknown in the biggest way you can imagine. They don't know why these beings are here or what they want, and it scares people.
Well, when you produce a movie that has a lot of good special effects in it, one of my good friends, his name is John Gress. He's a special effects a studio called Florida Effects. Did a lot of high-tech work on some of the best UFO films, space films that you can imagine. He has shot a movie called One Anunnaki, and he's basically attempting to bring the stories of Zachariah Sitchin to life on film.
Wow.
And the first film is done. It's in post-production now. It will come out later on this year. We'll probably make one of the film festivals toward the end of the year. It's an independent film, and it's taken a good challenge. I'm one of the technical advisors on the film, on the second movie, and
it's funny you should mention that. And one of the things that I made for certainty in the fact that I have these samples is that I sample these objects, and in sampling them, I was able to generate a color texture bitmap library for 3D applications and 2D applications, motion picture special effects, i.e., that was unlike any of the swatch colors, for example, Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, do not have these colors or these samples that I do. And because I sample them, the colors which were extracted from these UFOs maintain the spectral luminosity of the UFO, and when you applied it to a 3D object, it made the 3D object look more realistic.
Well, that's what we're attempting to do here, is make a film that is true.
All right, well, you can definitely pass those gentlemen on to me, because I have some samples that I believe can be utilized in a motion picture.
He's got the color swatch up there on the website of the colors that he extracted from the UFOs that he photographed. I mean, he took it right off the negative at high resolution. So, like you said, these are transferable to the grid that you would make in a computer-generated image?
Exactly. That's what in 3D Max, for example.
I've never seen anything quite like that.
Well, I'm going to put you in touch with them.
Absolutely. Please do. And have them go to my site. And on the site, you'll see the color library that was generated from each of the UFOs, which is very unique within itself.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Yep.
Outstanding. I was taking notes as fast as you guys could speak. I did not catch the author of The Keepers.
Oh, that's Jim Sparks.
Okay,
yeah. He's unusual because he's had multiple abductions, but he also has the most conscious recall of anybody that we know of. And he was able to articulate this well enough that they put together a book. And it's very instructive. I found it. It's a little disturbing, but you know, it's a heck of a story, and I just wish that people would realize that being in denial as an individual is unhealthy, but being in denial collectively as a species is not just unhealthy, it's unwise. We're leaving ourselves wide open to manipulation by those who are malevolent.
I've got to say, there is nothing more exhilarating than standing beneath a UFO. I've got to say that.
I have to say you're probably right.
It is something that, you know, in some cases, some people would definitely go through a few rounds of depends, you know. And in most cases, some people would run. But I stood there and I looked at this object, and I was amazed by what I saw.
I know I was about ready to run when the craft turned and came back down on us and got so bright. I have to admit that the fear came up inside of me because
were you burned?
No, it was too far up. It went over top of us probably about 20,000 feet, and we hit it with three lasers. It stopped, it turned, it came back, it came down on us, and got super bright. I mean, bright like a piece of lightning up there, and it was probably somewhere between 300 and 400 feet across.
Wow.
And then there were about 20 of us outside, and I know I had a sense of panic coming inside of me because I thought, it's coming down, it's going to come right, I don't have anywhere to go, I'm out here in the middle of a field.
It's strange, though, for people who have had constant contact, it no longer becomes a sense of panic. I was more amazed than anything. I was not afraid, and I knew what I was seeing. I was not hallucinating, because it was obviously registered on film. But at some point, most people, especially in my case, where I've made multiple contacts throughout the course of my life with whatever these superior life forms are, that at some point in my life, I started to feel acceptable to these visits. And now, in taking these photographs, that was all I needed to substantiate my claims as a child of being visited by extraterrestrials.
Well, Brooks, you know, what you experienced, the panic, that's very typical. I've experienced it. I know a lot of people have had who've had close encounters.
But I can't experience that.
But, Will, you've been conditioned because you started
exactly.
in an early age.
Exactly. I can't experience that.
Yeah. Well, it's a survival thing, you know. I mean, I'm not saying that they're all evil. I'm saying that some of them are clearly not benevolent. Okay? And the other thing is that we need to realize that we have done nothing to make them feel welcome. The good guys are not welcome here because we've never done anything to welcome them.
Well, no, they're afraid, and they know that if they come down, some mindless moron's going to shoot at them.
Well,
so who wants to come down to a hostile environment? And we have to say that the United States is not peaceful. It is a hostile environment.
Yeah, well, that's true. But that's all the more reason for us to think about our actions and decide consciously, collectively, decide whether or not we want to continue on this course.
No, Robert, I hate to say that, but there's not going to be this collective cohesion between humans because the intellectual levels of disparity are just too profound.
I wasn't asking for that, Will. I'm just saying let's take a test just to see, to get people. Because, look, at this point, everybody is more or less in denial. I suggest we at least let people think about the consequences of their actions and their thoughts. Because if these beings are not going to be welcome here, they'll continue coming anyway, covertly.
I completely agree. The consciousness is the most important thing, and it's the thing that we're going to pay the closest attention to when we put together this passenger list of 100 people. And they won't just be rich tourists. We're paying the way. Mm. We want the right people with the right consciousness and maybe the right science. We're going to put them on a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton nuclear-powered icebreaker.
Wow.
Take them to a place 1,000 miles from the nearest piece of civilization. And we're going to bring that boat to a level of consciousness that I have only witnessed at the workshops. And we're going to wait. And we're going to have that kind of atmosphere and that kind of level of acceptance.
Well, again, it's as you said, that those individuals that are going to be in that environment would be those that would be receptive to it. But look at the realities. Those individuals are going to be few and far between. There are just not that many people on this wavelength.
I know, but we're going to pare down thousands of applicants to 100.
And let's take that litmus test and see where we're at. If it's only 30% of the population that is pro-ET, then at least we know where we stand. And the rest of the people who are negatively against it, now they can't just say, well, this is all nonsense. No, they're going to have to make up their mind whether or not they want to have a open diplomatic relationship with these other life forms or not. And if they don't, nobody's trying to force it on them.
You're absolutely right, because look how quickly it swept under the carpet. The Chicago UFO incident,
yeah.
It was in a couple of days, no one heard anything about it ever again.
Well, it took a month before anybody ever leaked the information because they were all scared of losing their jobs.
Yeah, it was actually on Drudge Report.
Well, and I told you, I told Drudge, look, if you're going to cover UFOs, which happens to be my beat, at least report the most important UFO story of the century. You know, and I repeatedly tried to tell him that, but he's ignoring it because he figures, hey, I can ignore it. It's not important.
Exactly.
And, you know,
how abstract does it have to be for a UFO to land on the roof of the United States Capitol building and to get no action.
Well, because, look, Will, you know, it's so extraordinary that most people are not just skeptical. They can't fathom that this happened and nobody has ever, that the, you know, look, if they don't see it on TV, most people won't believe it anyway.
By the way, Robert, the anomaly that landed on a roof was large. When I went back to the Capitol last night, it was large comparative to the way it showed up on that image. Whatever that object was, it was huge on the roof of the Capitol.
Well,
we are reporting it here on X Squared Radio.
Thank you, Bruce.
That archive will stay up forever until someone hacks it and destroys it. But
I would emphasize that people go to www.unicusmagazine.com for the text story, and to go to ufodc.com to look at the visual samples. And the visual samples on that site are not altered. They're not manipulated in Photoshop. Those are straight, photographic, documented evidence of a UFO incursion that was photographed in July of 2002 at the United States Capitol.
You know, hey, there's something interesting about it, too, since you mentioned Photoshop. When Will sent me the original sample, he told me that what to look for. But now here's the funny thing. You only see the four objects, but when you start to play with the contrast and the brightness, now you see all the energy signature coming out. I mean, it literally is in another dimension, so you have to adjust.
It is embedded in the image.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen, Brooks. It's almost like magic, and I kept asking, well, how did you do that? And he said, I didn't. It's in the film.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this sample is profound in a lot of respects, in the first sense that it negates the laws of physics. So with that in mind, it is something to look at.
Well, those laws, though, but see, those laws are incomplete. As we know,
well,
we call them
laws.
Well,
we know it, but as we know it right now, that should not have happened.
Right. Well, in order to be a violation, though, you see what I'm saying? It's more of a, it's just pointing up the inadequacies of our current understanding of the laws of physics.
Sure, exactly right.
That's my only point. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just trying to...
No, I agree, because then, too, I'm not... physicist just yet, but it still comes in time.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Listen, Will, I am so glad that you came on the program tonight.
Thank you for having me on your show, sir.
No, it's not a problem at all. I think the last hour and a half has been absolutely fabulous, and this archive is going to be one of the most hit ones I can imagine. But I would like to leave the phone lines open for the last half hour so people can call in, and maybe you can keep listening. And, you know, listen to some of the questions, and then we can communicate by email later.
We can definitely do that. And, again, and most people who want to get in contact with me, you can contact me at ufodc@ufodc.com, or you can go to my website, ufodc.com, and contact me with the links that are available throughout the site.
Excellent. Thank you so much for
calling. Thank you, sir, for having me on your show. And, Robert, you have a good night.
You too, Will. Thank you.
All right, guys. Bye.
Good night.
So for whatever reason, Brooks, I was the only one that gave Will any opportunity to tell his story, and because of that, I got the exclusive on this, which I think is pretty big. But anybody could have had it before me if they would just taken the time to actually investigate.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I've had the same kind of response with the expedition, and I've gone to several producers who supply footage to Discovery Channel and History Channel and Science Channel and even National Geographic, and so far the producers are very excited when they first hear about it, but once they see that, hey, we're really serious, we're going to take some scientific measurements, we're going to take real film, we're going after this, yes, for entertainment purposes, but we're also doing it for informative purposes, because we would really like to know what the real structure of the Earth is.
Well, I certainly would. Did you happen to did you look over that document I sent you about the internet?
Yeah, I did.
PDF?
I did want to make it the subject of this show.
Yeah.
But, yes, I did. I take all that stuff in.
All right.
I already have another caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Robin from North Carolina.
Well, hello.
Well, hello.
Hi.
Hi, Robert. I have a question for you. Two of them, actually. One is, you were talking about when Will was taking pictures over the Capitol building in D.C., that he thought that these UFOs were creating a vortex in which they disappeared into, a dimensional vortex, or...
Right.
black hole or something like that? And you said he caught that on film? The
first time we ever know of anybody doing that, yeah, it was totally by accident.
And what did that look like? I mean, what did it look like? Was it something like that I could have looked at and thought, well, this is just clouds in the sky?
No.
Absolutely
not. No, in fact, that's why I say if you go to his website or mine, you'll see these pictures. He's got the better, larger blow-ups of the various analysis of that particular piece of film.
Is that at ufodc.com?
Correct, www.ufodc.com. And you'll actually see the energy signature in the sky. And where the energy patterns are, it looks digital, like a fractal. And the rest of the film is perfectly smooth and analog, and yet you go to that little area. Well, it's not a little area. They made a huge footprint in the sky of this energy field, and it literally warped space and allowed them to move into another dimension that took them out of here in just a heartbeat.
Now, these were like plasma type. These weren't like steel ships like we'd see.
Yes,
you know,
they are, Robin. They are very much so. But what's happening is the energy that they emit from the craft envelops the entire craft and ionizes the air, much like a lightning strike would do to the air. It lights up the air around it in multiple colors. In fact, you guys had a sighting over there in North Carolina recently, and the one photograph that I saw was very similar to the pictures that Will took. There's a blue envelope of energy enveloping the craft.
Yeah, and they said, right, and they claimed that that was like Chinese debris or satellite debris or something coming into the atmosphere.
Sure it is.
Okay. Well, then I have another question.
Go ahead.
Are you saying that there's an actual a craft in there, like I could like hit it with a hammer and go ding, ding?
Yep.
But because
well, not only that,
emits,
Robin, they were
like
shooting at them in 1952. President Truman ordered a shoot on sight, he issued orders to shoot on sight any of these UFOs because they're not responding to our radio communications, which is, you know, look, it is a threat. Despite what they may tell us, that is a threat. When an unknown object comes into your airspace and will not respond to any of your requests radio requests, of course the military is going to get concerned. And they did try shooting at one of the smaller ones that was remotely controlled. It was only about 2.5 feet across, very small disc, and they actually knocked a piece of the metal off, and it was analyzed. And it's definitely metal.
Okay, well, I understand you saying it's a threat when somebody doesn't respond, but if they respond at a different, let's face it, if they've got that kind of technology, they're probably not using our technology to communicate with. So
yeah,
it
probably sounds
it's probably, it's not that they're not trying to communicate, it's just that they're so far in advance that the radio waves are just something they probably don't even bother with. Wouldn't that make sense to you, Robert?
Well, that's true, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't dumb it down a bit just to communicate with us. I mean,
do we dumb ourselves down so horses can understand us?
We're not that far apart, Robin. Some of them are human, and they do monitor us, and some of them actually speak English. So, you know, I think you gotta broaden the horizon just a bit. Let's try and understand why they would even be here to begin with. What is so? If we're that dumb compared to them, why would they even be interested in us?
Well, like we're interested in a lot of things. Probably just to observe. It's probably interesting to see life forces, different life forces, you know, existing in any environment. Just like we observe our scientists and laboratories and biologists, around the world do.
Right.
You know, why do we bother doing it too? I mean, because it's interesting. It's something to do. I would imagine they probably have the same. They're up against the same stuff we are. They're looking for entertainment.
Wow.
I don't think that's beyond reality.
The
other thing I understand too is that even if these are beings and they are from another, your consciousness is as powerful as theirs. I mean, they have nothing over you in that way. Maybe. So why would you fear something that all you have to do is think them away or out of your, so that they do not mess with you, and they have to oblige?
Well, because here's my concern is that they have abducted people and returned them. We know that.
Yeah, but the people haven't thought them away, haven't asked them not to leave them alone. They've gone along with it. They haven't actually consciously made the demand, because those who do, every one of them will tell you they never bothered them again.
Well, that's wonderful, but that's all the more reason not to be in denial about it. I think collectively.
Right. Oh, I agree with you there.
Yeah, we need to acknowledge this is going on. Because one of the things we didn't mention is Mr. Allen actually met somebody who was abducted, a school teacher there in D.C., who was abducted on January 1st of 2006. And he was outside his home after the New Year's Eve festivities. He stepped out onto the sidewalk to have a smoke a cigarette, and he was abducted. At least that's what he claims.
Yeah.
And how this all came up was he was doing a night job, and he was over at Mr. Allen's house, and Mr. Allen plugged in this DVD of his images that he captured, and the man freaked out. He went into like a seizure, and he started reliving the events that happened to him on January 1st, 2006. And he kept saying, pink bubble gum, pink bubble gum. So Mr. Allen shut off the television set, and finally they calmed this man, this teacher, down. And he kind of briefly related what had happened to him, but he was so he was totally out of control. I mean, he was still living through post-traumatic stress. And he had a horrible flashback just seeing those images.
Yeah, and if he's not prepared for something like that, I agree, you're going to have somebody who's going to probably panic and respond that way, just like you would in any situation.
Hey, but you know, Robin, conversely, there's a lot of examples where people have seen during the daytime, large UFOs hovering over the city, and they didn't panic at all.
Right.
They didn't.
Well, I'll tell you, I believe my generation, I mean, maybe the 50s generation would have had a problem with it, but since then, the children that they had and the children that those children have had and the next ones, they pretty much, nobody's panicking over the thought that there may be life forms out there visiting this planet, or there's a possibility of it, nor would they sweat it if they did.
Right, and statistically you're correct, because I've got Roper polls and National Geographic polls that I list in my book, both from 2002 and 2005, and you're right. Statistically, more than ever now, people are they're open to this, they're not scared of it, and they wouldn't have a problem if we were to interact with peacefully with alien life forms, especially
now,
if some of them are human.
Do you think that is the reason that is because of the plethora of movies that have come out that have kind of made it socially acceptable to talk about it? Or do you think it's because the number of sightings and the number of credible people that are talking about sightings have gone up and thus made it more realistic, not so movie acceptable, but more realistic to people?
It's a combination of both. There's apparently, what I've been told is that there's a program underway to gradually acclimate people to this reality. I mean, look, they started off really bad with that whole War of the Worlds being broadcast as a real event. I mean, most people thought it was a real event happening in, oddly enough, in New Jersey. You know, one of the things I kind of got to back up here, I found out that statistically Washington, D.C. has more UFO sightings per square mile than any other place on the planet, and not by a little bit either. I'm talking thousands of times greater than any other place. Now, the other 10 runners-up for that kind of UFOs per square mile, they're all states around Washington, D.C. So bottom line is the East Coast is the spot where they go the most of any place on this planet. I still don't know why. Of course, we're just speculating on this. But isn't it odd that the War of the Worlds supposedly, fictionally, took place there? Then what did you have? The Day the Earth Stood Still. Where was that? Oh, yeah, Washington, D.C. Then we had Earth versus the Flying Saucers. Again, Washington, D.C., East Coast. So there's something that somebody was trying to give us a message there. Of course, it was a very negative one, trying to make people feel paranoid. And actually, War of the Worlds was the first time that anybody ever threw out this idea that, you know, if there's life out there, they got to be bad. They have to have evil intentions towards Earth. And I don't think that's completely the whole story. I think there's a lot of good people on other worlds, too, and I think we are related to them. And we would probably benefit greatly from having an open diplomatic relationship and an exchange with them. But getting to that point is going to be difficult.
Well, that's what I want to kind of talk about the last 10 minutes of our program.
Okay.
Let's take it for granted that we are not alone in the universe, that there is intelligent life out there. And let's even take it for granted that many of those races are visiting us here on this Earth. Now, we are also making our little baby steps out into space ourselves, or we may be remaking our steps out into space. I don't know. Maybe past civilizations did have that kind of activity.
Right.
Taking all that into account, we as a race are about to metamorphize. We are about to change into a galactic being. We're about to change from fighting over one little piece of ground here on the Earth or water rights or something like that to rejoining the community in the stars. That is a major change for a society.
Oh, it's an evolutionary leap for us back to our true origins. That's if I understood you correctly. And you know, are you familiar with the report that Commander Robert Dean has gone public with?
No, I'm not.
Okay, it's in the book. It's a whole chapter in there with Commander Dean. But see, he's the first person of, I think, that is a high-ranking officer to expose the fact that the military had already put together a very comprehensive study back in the 60s, early 60s, called Assessment Military Threat. They were trying to come to a conclusion to the very question we were just talking about. Are these beings a threat to us or not? Their conclusion back in the early 60s was no, they're not an overt threat to us, but they do want to have some interaction with us on a limited basis. And that's why the flyovers and ultimately landings and other forms of contact. But they said, now this is in 63, Commander Dean read this at NATO when he was he had a very high security clearance for shock and shape. That was all part of NATO. And he said that what he saw shocked him to the core of his being. He said that they concluded that there was at least four races of beings visiting of us. One was the taller gray, bald-headed beings. The other was the smaller grays, which were some sort of android. Then he had the reptilians, and then you had the humans. And he said the humans were the ones that really bothered the military the most because, quite obviously, they could infiltrate if they felt like it, and it wouldn't be an issue. So that's a matter of historic fact. I've talked with Commander Dean at length many times face-to-face, and I don't think he's just blowing smoke on this. I really think that he saw that assessment, and that's what they concluded.
Well, I had Charles Hall on the program last year, and he talked about his book...
The Tall Whites.
And how they would occasionally slip into Las Vegas in disguise and really didn't draw that much attention.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to Mr. Hall, and I've read some of his stuff, and I can't speak to the credibility of his allegations, but I do know about Commander Dean, and he's a big fan of Sitchin, and I think you must know Sitchin was saying that we were created in their image by these Anunnaki human extraterrestrials, but they didn't come here to set up some utopian democratic society. They came here to expand their empire.
Right.
Okay, which is a kingship. It's an empire, and they are empirical. So you can't expect them to suddenly do something democratic for us or to us at any point. And if we were created by them or are related to them, then you know they're warlike as well. It's part of their process of defense as well as further maintaining the empire.
Well, I'm going to let you guys go I'll just leave one more question for you to answer before I go.
Sure.
They're also subject to the same thing we are. They are mortal at some point, even what Sitchinson said. Have to deal with the consciousness at the next level or dimension or life existence, however we decide to explore it.
I agree.
So if we're all into that same, if everything dies in a mortal form, eventually it all gets to that higher consciousness form where we all kind of get together. So.
True.
I don't know. I'm not panicking over what happens here now.
Good.
But I don't know. What do you think? Bye.
Oh, wow. That was a heck of a question. Okay.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, we all go to this consciousness, this collective consciousness of the universe because we're all beings in it. So what do you think?
I agree with that. But here's what she doesn't know or didn't read about Sitchin and should probably look at again. Is he talking quite extensively about a tree of life that was denied to humans. Why? Because it would grant us physical immortality.
Right.
Okay? The Masons know a lot about this. In fact, the National Mall is laid out to correspond to the Tree of Life.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just a metaphor, okay, Brooks? I could tell you what I've learned about the technology, what it really is, emulates the Godhead. And it's all about frequencies and the octaves and the way that they either work in harmony for resonance or they work in discord for dissonance. One creates, the other destroys.
That's right.
Okay, so this device, which we loosely call the Tree of Life, has been denied us because the gods, our ancestors, our creators, whatever you want to call them, our relatives, they denied us that, and we're still being denied it. And just so you know, physical immortality is actually a blessing and a curse. Unless we were mature enough to handle that, we would soon find ourselves in a huge pickle because our resources would run out more quickly. And you'd have to stop. Unless you could start traveling into space and colonizing other worlds, we'd have to stop multiplying. We couldn't have any more children.
That's right.
Okay? So you got to think about this. Every technology is a double-edged sword. It can be used for good, or it may just have a side effect. It's really bad. And I think that's another reason. I don't think they were just being cruel to us. I think that was why that they realized as an immature species or race, whatever you want to call us, that we couldn't handle the responsibility of being immortal. However, if we were, I think we'd be a heck of a lot smarter now. You know, because if you live to be 100 years old, you've certainly learned a lot just through experience, nothing else. But if you live to be 1,000 or more years old, you're going to be pretty wise, I would imagine, you know, compared relatively speaking.
I would think so. And I wouldn't doubt that there aren't some multiple thousand-year-old humans on this planet right now.
Right. Right. Well, I'm sure you're right about that. But I think in the general, my understanding is, Robin's right, there is a matrix of energy, the Godhead, whatever you want to call it, that where all intelligent life emanates from. And I'm not talking about physically either. I'm just talking about our souls. And the ETs have nothing to do with that directly. That's
right.
Something that we all have. We all have our own connection to that. And we should, I think, it would be very wise if we would strengthen that connection.
Well, I think I agree with that. I believe that we are eternal beings having a mortal experience,
mm-hmm.
and we may have many, many of them, maybe not back-to-back, but the accumulation of that, we become a wiser and wiser being, and hopefully at this time on our world, we are reaching a point where we are gaining control of our own future instead of walking down one that was mapped out by prophets thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what I was saying, though, about having a vote. If the good guys want to come down, even if they have the best intentions, if they're not welcomed by at least a majority of the people, we will see that as an invasion. Even if they're the good guys and they're trying to help us, you see, our perception will be, oh, my God, see, they're invading. And we'll take a very defensive posture. So I think the good guys know that already, and that's why they're trying to encourage us to do something, to take some even very tiny little steps towards consciously relating with them before that they can take any measures to physically, overtly step out and say, hi, yeah, we're here.
So then I guess the answer to the question, when is global first contact going to occur is when you're ready.
Right, right. And that's why I want to take a vote. Put it to a vote. It's very painless. It's not going to cost a bunch of money. I don't think anybody needs to get killed over this. And we're going to just find out where we stand. And you know, honestly, even if an individual doesn't sit down and take the time to plug in the numbers on the computer or the telephone, the mere fact that they run that through their brain, that they process that question in their mind, gee, do I want to have conscious contact, open diplomatic dialogue or exchange with alien life forms? No, I don't want to do that. Well, if they think that, it'll be registered, because I guarantee you the good guys and the bad guys, they're monitoring our brainwaves. And our brainwaves are running all the time, even when we're sleeping. Our brainwaves are being emitted, and they can be registered. I mean, hey, even NASA's been working out ways to monitor our brainwaves remotely.
Perfectly said, and a good way to end what seems to be the fastest 3 hours on radio. I appreciate so much you coming on the program.
My pleasure,
and
brother.
For Will Allen coming on, too. What a wealth of information, and I really am looking forward to working with both of you further.
Thank you.
And I will see you at the Conscious Life Expo on sometime between Friday through Sunday.
Okay.
All right, my friend.
Thanks, Brooks. You take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Good night. And with that, my friends, I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.